Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to episode 37. There's probably more than one of you. I'm joking. To episode 37 of Ladies with Gumption, called Legacies. This week, we are continuing to recap DCTV in a flash, even though we have one less DCTV to recap. I am your introductress, Tatiana, and I am here with
Jessica
and May.
Yay! Now, you can find us at DCTV Gumption on Twitter, Ladies W Gumption on Tumblr, and ladieswgumption at gmail.com if you want to send us nice long feedback. Or you can individually contact us at Falling in Love in a Flash for Jessica, Her Own Hero Writer for May, and Valerie M. Bettis for Tatiana. And as always, you can listen to our podcast on Podomatic.com, on iTunes, or on Google Play. Before we get into the thick of things, we wanted to remind you guys to check out hashtag June is for Candace. Check on Falling in Love in a Flash, which is Jessica's Tumblr, for the information on how we're going to make the month of June special for the lovely Candace, whose birthday will be on the 24th of it. And also we'll be putting up a poster specifically for the first theme, because every week is going to be a different theme for Candace, both on Jessica's Tumblr and on Ladies W Gumption. We also have a little bit of news, which is basically just casting calls, because there isn't really anything else going on. We don't really know what else is happening other than seasons are ending. So, starting with Arrow, because it ended It ended first. We can talk about Arrow Season 7, having lost two series regulars. Looks like they're picking up quite a few. First, we've got a new Star City Police detective, or at least seems like it's going to be the new, you know, connection to the police force. She's going under the name of Jessie Bowden. We don't know if that'll actually be her name. You know, casting calls often change. But she's supposed to be white, yay, and either late teens or early 20s. So she's the rookie recruit at the department. Despite being youthful, she's supposed to hate vigilantes and wants to get rid of them no matter what it takes. I believe the casting call called her Buffy the Superhero Slayer. So that's nice. We've also got a Daniel Porter, who again is white, in his mid-30s. I just thought that it was important that you guys know this.
Exactly. Why? Never Arrow? Foreseen. Why?
Show stop. So he's supposed to be a gay tech entrepreneur. All right. So he's had huge success as a businessman, but also suffered tragic losses. So
he's like Oliver the tech guy.
Yeah. It sounds like that might tie in with Curtis and Felicity's tech company. And also sounds like Curtis is about to dump his boyfriend, whose name I can never remember, but whose relationship I care about deeply.
His name is Nick.
Tati. She cares deeply. She can't remember his name.
What was his name, maybe? Right. Maybe he must tell me.
His name is Nick.
Nick. Okay. See, yeah. It should be a hard name to remember. It's because it's so deceptively simple. And then finally, and perhaps most importantly, we have a female character going by the name of Kenomi Rhodes in the casting call, and she's specifically half Japanese, half white, to be somewhere in her late 20s or early 30s. She's like a street fighter, but also a military tactician. And it sounds
That's
like she's
a combination, to be honest. Street fighter, yeah. But also a military tech.
Yes. I think she's going to be a regular for season 7. Now, one character that is very prominent in Green Arrow comics that is half Japanese and half white is Emiko Queen, who is Oliver's half-sister. Right, not Thea, but the other half-sister in the comics. So I will just start laughing and never stop if Oliver now has two half-sisters, one from each parent, just because we have to literally replace Thea. So yeah,
that was weird. Like right when Thea leaves, all of a sudden Emiko shows up.
I'd be like, The other weird thing is that in the comics, she's Shadow's daughter because Shadow was her dad's girlfriend. Obviously, this time she will not be Shadow's daughter.
I mean, it does It does feel like replacement 2.0 because you have the half sister and also like the police detective, which is what Lance sort of was.
That's true.
So that's
you are very wise. I did not think of this. But yeah, so there's something interesting going on there. I'm assuming at the very least, even if she's not actually Emiko, she will have connection to the Yakuza, and that's why they want her to be half Japanese, which is like Shadow.
Like, if they're going to make it that specific in their casting call, then she needs to be half Japanese, like, for real.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. She better be, I mean, considering everyone else is white, she better be half Japanese.
Not just character, the actress better be half Japanese.
Yeah, no, of course, of course. I agree with this. Moving on to The Flash, they only gave us one breakdown because they hate us. And they are, it's for the big bad, or it seems like it's for the big bad. I'm not going to say it is. But it seems like it's the big bad for season 5. It's a fractional series regular, which is also what I believe The Thinker was last season. And the name they gave is Desmond Paul, which is not a name. So, you know, that's not who it is. It's open ethnicity for a man in his 40s, because that's where their villains live, I guess. In their 40s. Actually, other than Savitar, obviously. But he acted like a man in his 40s. So, anyway.
He was hundreds of years old.
Right. Well, this guy is also hundreds of years old. Oh. He's a metahuman who, after a mysterious encounter with dark matter, got immortality and also the ability to dampen other metahuman powers. And he blames metahumans for everything that's happened to him and wants them gone. I think it's Cicada, mostly because of that rumor that we heard from before the season.
Dagger.
Yeah. About someone with a lightning bolt dagger was going to show up in the final episode, and that's going to let you know that Cicada was this villain for next season. I'm going to assume that's true, and also because he's also immortal, and he blames the Flash for him killing his own wife. He killed his own wife, and somehow this is the Flash's fault.
Of course it is. Everything is Barry's fault.
And everything that's Barry's fault in the comics, or in the show, is Wally's fault in the comics. So there's that too. What Cicada does in the comics is go around killing every person the Flash saved.
Oh.
He wants them all to be dead because I don't know why.
Just somehow it pulls out like his wife being resurrected one day or something.
Yeah, exactly. So basically it sounds like TV show Savitar, but.
Yeah. And that would be interesting because it has the potential for them to draw on everybody in like season 1, 2 and new people. And although for the Flash casting call too, it's like, this should be the only one because we already know who I guess is probably going to be series regulars anyway, because they're already on the show.
Yeah. This is very true. And then finally we have a couple for Supergirl. The first one is the most exciting. Mia Nall, who is a transgender character. She's a trans woman in her early 20s, open ethnicity. She is basically an aspiring journalist. So she's going to be part of the Catco family. And we just says that she's confident and hardworking, like a young Cat Grant. So
I'm a little nervous about it because like the girl hasn't really like even mastered just women of color in general and making their show less super white. So then you add on to that, like, another special interest group and add in, like, a transgender person, and that's even more of a sensitive topic to kind of navigate. And I don't know. I'm it's good that they're reaching for more inclusion, but I guess we'll just wait and see.
We don't know yet how big of that is going to play into the identity of the person, too. Like, are they going to mention it? Is it going to be, like, a part of this big story, you know? So
they haven't really, they've been hit or miss in a lot of like social issues. And so this is a big one to tackle.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And like a regular character on the show.
Yeah. And basically we just don't trust the Supergirl writers. So.
They did a good job with Alex's story, but I mean, we'll see.
Well, they did a good job with Alex's side of the story. With Maggie, not so much. Like, in terms of her background.
Yeah, the Maggie side of the story wasn't as good as the Alex side. I hope that they do it well. And, of course, I hope they cast a trans woman in the role. Because that would be a start. Casting what they asked for. All right, we also have a character named Ben, a white guy in his 40s, a businessman. Wow. Yeah. They're just coming right out with it. They're like, listen, yeah, he used to be successful, and then it, like, went up in flames. Something. And he's also blaming people for his failure, so that's interesting. Also, he's very good at persuading people.
Morgan Edge just completely disappeared.
Yes, right, this is like say. Morgan Edge 2.0. Or, like, less successful Morgan Edge.
This sounds familiar.
Yeah. And they said they want a Michael Shannon type. I don't know what that means, but... Does Michael Shannon do this? Does he blame other people for his actions? And creepily good at persuading them? I don't know. So anyway, we've also got a Colonel Haley, who is a woman, or mid to late 40s. And they said, it says diverse actress, which I think is different from open ethnicity in that it means not white. But I'm also pretty sure that it can just mean white. Because if a white person walks in, they'll just gas them. Yeah. But oh, so open ethnicity.
That's why I don't like the open stuff, because I'm just like, yeah. But that just means you're probably going to cast a white person. That's not.
Yeah.
Yeah, but so, you don't want to say that you're casting
a white person. Right, right. Like, exactly. We had it open for everyone, but the white person was the most talented. I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Exactly. So she is someone you don't want to mess with, even when she doesn't speak, because her, like, commanding presence comes from not what she says, but what she doesn't say. So that's cool. And then finally, I think that's finally, we have the one that I actually know who it might be from the comics. Chester Green, who is British, open ethnicity, but British, in his 20s or 30s. So it's something like, he's the guy who brings a gun to a knife fight and walks away the winner or something like that. Or walks away without going to jail. I don't know. Something like that.
You know, you are the gun to a knife fight.
Yeah. I thought he brought a knife to a gunfight and, like, walks away.
If it was the opposite, if he brought a knife to a gunfight and then he won, then that would be
You know
something.
What? That's probably what it is. That's what it is. He brings a knife to a gunfight. I said it wrong. He's doing a knife to a gunfight and still walks away the winner. That's what it is. And he's also very charming, so you don't realize how brutal he is. So I'm pretty sure this is Magister Black, who is a villain, or an anti-hero turned villain, from the comics, and he has gone up against Superman before, as well as in some movie called Superman versus the Elite. So that would make something.
Is that an animation?
Yeah, it's an animated film. And in the comics, he's got telepathy and telekinesis. So we'll see.
Interesting. Supergirl has a lot of casting calls.
Yeah. So there you go. We got lots of things coming around the bend for lots of shows next season. I don't have anything for Legends, but you know. They have enough characters as it is, and
Legends
they have new characters
just
every episode.
To tell
so.
Me if Wally is going to be a series regular or not, because I don't understand. He's on the poster. I'm concerned. That's all.
That's what we deserve to know.
I know.
But alas. Alas. All right. So, now that that's out of the way, May is going to recap Supergirl, Krypton, and Flash for us out of one side. Right, there's no side A and side B. It's just all one huge side. And we're going to talk about what we like, what we don't like, what we predict either for the rest of Supergirl or next season for Flash and Krypton. And then finally, we will nominate a Lady of Gumption for the week from each show, if applicable. And then we will vote. Yay! And then I hope that we will each pick one from a different show. We're going to have a three-way showdown. Yes. And it'll be like 12 angry men, but it'll be three angry women. All right. Goodbye. And hello, May, and her recap.
All right. On Supergirl, Alex is struggling to cheer Ruby up and get her to connect after the discovery that her mom is Rain. No matter what Alex does, Ruby doesn't really respond. Meanwhile, John is struggling with Mirren's dementia and doesn't know what to do. He ends up telling that he ends up telling Alex that he read 3D video games can help to kickstart cognitive functions. So he and Alex take Ruby and his dad to a video arcade, and Ruby is still reluctant to get in on the fun. After he has an episode, she discovers that he is an alien from Mars, and they bond in a nice scene that allows Ruby to open up to Alex in a vulnerable moment. Ruby fears that she will end up just like her mom. Alex assures her that that won't be the case and that her friends are working on finding a cure. She promises Ruby that she'll protect her for as long as she lives. Meanwhile, Kara is angry at James for telling Lena that Supergirl was the one who asked Guardian to find out if she was using kryptonite. Then she expresses her frustration regarding her relationship with Lena. Lena doesn't think she and Supergirl were ever friends, and Kara doesn't like that she doesn't trust Supergirl but trusts Kara, but she can't tell Lena to trust either identity. very confusing. And somehow she's still stubborn and doesn't want to just reveal the truth to Lena and save everyone a big headache. Then Tanya, the woman who stole Koval's book from last episode, seeks out James for help because she knows he knows Supergirl. She was working to decipher the language of the book and discover that Koval's followers are making a bomb, not long after she is kidnapped by Olivia, who is now running the cult. James saves her as guardian, but is suspected by the police as the one who tried to take Tanya after his mask is destroyed. James and Tanya manage to escape, and she's happy to find out that it's James who's guardian, since knowing Supergirl now makes more sense to her. Koval's cult sends him a message threatening to release footage of him as guardian to the public unless he turns in Tanya in the book. James later reveals to Lena that he wants to out himself to the public before the cult does so that he can take control of the situation. He then says that he's worried about the public discovering the guardian is a black man behind the mask. Being guardian allows him to help people without being judged by the color of his skin, but by what's in his heart and his actions. In a vulnerable moment, he tells Lena the story of when he was arrested at 7 years old at a hotel while playing hide-and-seek and how the cops didn't believe they were guests there. Meanwhile, Lena discovers that it isn't the bomb that killed the person they found in the beginning of the episode, but the Rock of Yuta-Kal, which the cult is using to create a new world killer. Kara feels guilty about Olivia because she thinks she's partly to blame for her following in Koval's footsteps, and also feels terrible about lying to Lena. Monel is there to tell her that she shouldn't feel guilty and that maybe not telling Lena her secret is perhaps the best idea. Before James has the chance to reveal himself, Tanya gives herself up so Monel ends up in the same truck as her as a klutzy pedestrian Mike, and then takes down the guard. But Olivia has already completed the ritual to change herself into a world killer. Supergirl swoops in to save the day and helps to stop Olivia with empathy and talking her down and helps her remove the rock that is attached to her hand. In the end, James decides not to reveal himself, but when the time is right, he will. He and Kara apologize to each other. James says he understands the importance of a secret identity and says sorry for putting her in a weird position with Lena. Kara says no, it's her fault for asking him to spy on Lena to begin with. Supergirl and Mon-El end up on a mission together to go and locate the source of the rock, which is light years away, so they fly away in Jean's car, and that's what you missed on Supergirl. Whew! Ladies, what did we think? What did we like?
Well, I was nervous and / skeptical when I found out about, you know, Super White was going to attempt to tackle James and racism in America. So, like, seeing how well that worked out when they tried to cover other social issues, like, you know, what it means to be a white person playing a Mexican in America. So I was like, oh, I don't know about this. But I'm actually, like, really moved by James's speech and that he had that moment of vulnerability with Lena. So I thought that was – I was impressed, actually, by – how well they incorporated that story into the episode. There's other things overall that I didn't like, but I did like his moment with Lena where you guys talk about it specifically. I love that she wanted to stand with him in the event that he had to come clean to the world and come out as guardian, that she was like, I'm going to stand by you and, you know, be kind of be like your strength while you're going through this. So I thought that was really nice. And like I was saying that there's one aspect of the scene that I didn't like, although it really has nothing to do with either actor, because I thought both Macaw and Katie hit it out of the park and they were really kind of vulnerable with each other. And like Macaw's acting almost is like on par with his reacting to Jeremy's like deathbed speech in the last episode. So I thought it was a good, like really standout moment for him. James questioning being a black vigilante also meant that Supergirl had to hire another black person for him to interact with to see what it was like to come out on the positive side to it. So now we got a black woman on the show, so that's great. At least for, you know, one episode. So yay, diversity.
And she didn't end up being a villain. I'm so pleased.
And she was not a villain. So yay. It was really nice to see Tracy like fangirl over the Guardian. And the fact that it was James, because, like, first of all, she's like, oh, my God, you're Guardian, you're so cool. And then she's like, James, she's like, oh, my God, you're a black man, you're so cool. You know, it just kind of underscored how much he actually means not only to her, but to National City.
Yes.
Last season, during his kind of growing pains becoming Guardian, that wasn't really ever clear that the city wanted him or thought of him at all. So her being like, yo, you're a superhero, you're super, was like really cute. And I think a much needed confident boost for an underappreciated character. So I thought that was like really nice for James. I will never quite be known as like, I am known Mon-El stan. Like that will not be me. But those are not words that will come out of my mouth, but I did feel like, and I keep reiterating how much I've been liking this version of Monel recently and how much I wish this version was the version that we could have started with. Like, it's clear that when they're not being saddled by crabby, sexist writing, you can see that there is some chemistry there between Melissa and Chris, which, I mean, it helps, you know, they're also dating, but even if they weren't dating, you still see, like, when there's actually a good story between them, then you can kind of see that, like, natural chemistry come out. I thought their bangarang catchphrase is cute, even though I have no idea where it came from, because clearly I didn't pay attention to them like that. So I don't know where it came from, but it's cute. Plus, Monel didn't feel like a burden to me in this episode. Like, could Carr have gone, be the one to go undercover on the mission rather than give Chris a chance to reprise Mike? Sure. But the scene still worked. I thought Mike, quote unquote, in that situation was funny. And then seeing as how he had to transform into Valor once they reached, like, the destination, Monel's human identity getting blown matters much less than Kara's getting blown. So maybe that's why they chose to go with that. I thought he gave good advice to Kara about telling her the truth and, like, you know, seeing where it went, because Lena deserved to know the truth. And then when it blew up the whole, like, telling the truth only to make yourself feel better, in that situation, you're being kind of selfish, and not telling the truth is a noble thing. I could tell that line had a dual meaning, because it was basically what he was going through, whether or not to tell Kara. And that was also confirmed later in his conversation with John. I kind of liked that little through line right there. And it was the thing that I was most nervous about last week, so I'm really happy that's not what's happening, because I was really afraid that, you know, Monel is just going to, like, unload on Kara and then just, like, leave, and that would be it. And I was like, I don't want that. And it looks like Monel doesn't want that either, so I'm happy. And then Tati doesn't like the fight between Kara and Lena, but I liked it.
Yeah. Just, I like, Tati's just displeased with the overall storyline about this, and we're just like, yes, tension.
Tension, yes. Because it basically, like, reconfirms what I said last week about, you know, Kara can't have it both ways and argue with Lena as Supergirl, but then maintain the same trust and friendship as Kara. Like, it's not fair to Lena. And I like to say, like, you know, on her Lena's drag across National City, like, despite what Kara might think, I don't think about you when I'm doing it. Like, when she's doing, like, research, she's like, is this going to hurt Supergirl? Like, I don't really think about that. And then another of my favorites on my top 10 list of Lena dragging Kara. Like, it's easy to admit a mistake when you've been exposed. And it's like, oh, boom, drop the mic. That's the only reason why, like, Kara's really apologizing, is because James told Lena that, you know, what Kara did. So if James hadn't told Lena, then Kara definitely wouldn't have told her. So I like that line. And then finally, Marin and Ruby kind of healing each other at the arcade when John and Alex respectively couldn't was really touching, and it was like a sweet moment for them. And it kind of, like, brought both C-plots together, like two minor storylines bringing together in a really nice healing way.
Aww. I agree with that last one.
But all the others.
Oh, no. I agree with most of it. All right. There was a lot of good stuff this week, and I was rather surprised because I have been kind of down on Supergirl recently. But like Jess said, I was skeptical, especially about it broaching police brutality. But I do think that this is the best job they've ever done tackling a real-world social justice issue. The other thing they've done best, in my opinion, this season is the Marin plot with him losing his memories. Like, that's, like, analogous to dementia, and it is, you know, just as painful watching him as it is in real life to experience or to have a family member experience. So both those things, I think, have been really good. Although, of course, this one only lasted one episode, so it's not quite the same. But probably what makes it the best is having a black man standing in for a black man instead of a white person playing an alien or an Italian playing a Latina. So that helps a lot. I also love his dynamic with Tanya a lot. And I liked how they both wanted to protect each other, you know, and they both, like, went out of their way to try to help the other person, and, like, that they worked together really well, and they also, like, didn't wind up betraying each other or wind up accidentally, turning on the other, etc. I also loved that James got to talk about his traumatic experiences, you know, as a child with cops, etc., with Lena, and that she was there for him throughout the whole thing, and that she just kind of, like, let him talk and, like, didn't interject with, like, oh, well, maybe, blah, 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 blah. So that was nice. I personally thought that Kara and James' friendship came out of the episode looking much better than some other friendships on the show. I liked how she apologized. She admitted that she was wrong asking James to spy on Lena. And he also, you know, apologized just because he's a nice guy for putting her in that position. And that's when she was like, no, it was me who did the wrong thing in the first place. So I liked that. And I also liked that they did their best to try to explain how James being willing to come up with his identity and Kara not being willing to were different. Like, it failed, but James was the one that came the closest. So A for Everett James. I also liked, like Jess pointed out, how positively National City sees Guardian. Like, it was really important for us to see that, because in season two, often, it kind of felt like the show was bordering on mockery of James with the Guardian storyline. Especially with Kara being all like, oh, you're not even, you know, super, so like, why are you doing this? You're just gonna get yourself killed. And like, there was never any, like, you know, indication that people liked Guardian. So I'm glad that now we get indication.
I feel like there was even one storyline last season where, like, a woman thought Guardian was, like, breaking into her house or something.
Yeah, it was like, yeah, there was one storyline where they thought he was the villain to begin with. So right. I was like, okay. So, yeah, so I'm glad that they've cleaned that up a little bit. And it helps that we're not seeing Guardian as much this season either. We're getting to see James as the hero that he is in his daily life more often, which is what I prefer anyway. So, yay! Yay for everything! Okay. Alex and Ruby, John and Marin, that whole, like, dual family, you know, like, double date, but, like, double family time was a lot of the fun. And I thought it was really nice, unexpected parallel to draw between them. And how it's all, like, they really are all like family. Because, like, Alex and John are like family, and now they've both got these struggling members of their family, you know, adding new members to their families. And since they don't know how to handle the situations with them, they lean on each other to do it. And I liked Alex having to learn that lesson. Sometimes people need to grieve on their own, you know, to let people ride it out and then come out the other end. And I thought it was really cute that basically Ruby came out of her shell with Marin, just like both helping each other out of their respective funks and playing foosball. The most adorable game of foosball on television. Yes, Ruby's already making Alex, you know, Alex is on her way to being a great mother. I'm so excited. So proud. Finally, I did enjoy Mon-El reprising Mike a lot. I thought it was a lot of fun. And that Chris Wood has excellent comedic timing. So that whole scene was very cute. Yay, Mike. And now it's Nate's turn.
Oh, yes, I will agree about that. Mon-El as Mike actually did make me laugh. And I think it was funny because it was so obvious and a bit ridiculous, but it worked.
Like, they just took it with them. They're like, okay, we're fine. Yeah.
And like, why can't they make Chris Wood be funny without being a jerk? Season two could have been so much better. Anyway, I also adored the Ruby plot with Alex and John and Mirren, as like you guys said. And this is the family stuff I live for. And having Ruby bond with Mirren on an emotional level was super sweet and made my heart full, and it was very nice to see. And then her opening up to Alex and asking if she thinks what happened to Sam could happen to her broke my heart, but like in a satisfying way. And I love that Alex got to be there with her and promised to protect her. I was worried about Supergirl as well, doing a storyline about being a black man in America or a black man in National City. And I also agree that it was the best they've ever done a real world type of story. Mikad did an amazing job. He really sold the hell out of it. And his story really made me feel for him and how anguished he sounded. And I'm so glad that it was Lena he was opening up to, because it just continues that trust and openness in their relationship. I like that James did get to bond with Tanya and agree about getting to see how National City citizens feel about vigilantes and him in particular. And I especially like James' thinking in the end and how he said he would reveal himself when the time is right, because people like Tanya deserve to see a hero who looks like them so they know what they're capable of. And I really like that line. And I'm not going to lie, it really affected me. The Carrollson friendship still exists. I'm amazed. I was so happy that James and Kara got to talk stuff out and that they both were able to understand and see each other's perspective. Finally, the look on Kara's face when Lena told her she and Supergirl weren't friends. My eyebrows rose so high. It was epic. And I can't believe it. Lena was the queen. She was the queen of one-liners and clapbacks this episode, and I salute her. Yay, Lena. But what did we not like?
Kara.
LOL.
Kara's the only Lady of Gumption of the Week nom for me today. She just, like, really aggravated me all episode over this Lena situation. And, like, firstly, accusing Lena of building another weapon just because it mildly inconvenienced her not being able to see. Like, I really agree, like, you know what I say with Lena, like, it really, you know, I was thinking in my head, too, like, she's not thinking about you when she's, like, coming up with stuff. She's trying to, like, stop Rain. So, like, stop making it all about you for, like, 1 second, please. You know? And there's, like, the whole conversation with her trying to blame James for a situation she created in the first place. I thought that was ugly. Like, all throughout this argument, I was just thinking, like, this is why you don't get in the middle of friend drama, people. Because you either wind up getting, like, playing run and tell that between two friends, or you get blamed for other people's issues. And James is being blamed for other people's issues. And I feel like the whole secret identity excuse is weak in the first place. Like, Kara argues if Lena knew her identity, she could be a target. But then Tracy kind of undercuts Kara's entire premise by coming up to James, like, hey, James, I know you're close to Supergirl. And everybody knows James is close to both Supergirl and Superman, for that matter. So if people knew that who I was target, if she knew who I was target, I think it's just, like, bullshit. Because, you know, how is James still, like, walking around and running Catco in the first place if he's, like, supposedly a target because he knows both Supergirl and Superman, you know? Plus, like, how would bad guys even know to target Lena because she knows Supergirl's identity in the first place? Like, wouldn't the opposite be more likely and more dangerous? Like, a villain finds out on their own that Supergirl is Kara, and then because Kara explains to Lena, kidnaps Lena. Like, in that case, Kara shouldn't have any friends at all, because whoever finds out her identity is just going to go after all of her friends, so just don't have any friends, Kara, if that's what you're worried about.
And, right.
Like, Kara blurts out to Tanya that she's also friends with Supergirl, so I guess her human identity is also a quote-unquote target because of her very public relationship with herself.
Right.
So, like, none of this makes any sense to me.
It really doesn't. It's so frustrating.
Yeah. It's like, how would a villain know that Lena knows unless Lena tells him that she knows who Supergirl is? You know, like, how would that even work? Like, the other side is more likely to happen. So, like, the whole, I guess this is, like, a larger problem with comics in general about the whole secret identity thing, because you're not really protecting them. You know, she's just going to get kidnapped one day for something that she doesn't even know about. And plus, Lena gets kidnapped all the time. So, like, adding Supergirl to the list isn't, like, it's another day of the week for her. So, you know, it's not really, a solid argument to me. And then, like, on the rest of the episode, Olivia, the white woman terrorist, I remember her from earlier in the season, and although I think it's a little bit far-fetched that she's now the leader of this, like, cult or whatever it is. And I don't know if it was, like, a conscious choice to have James' adversary be a white woman, but, like, she used, like, number one, she used her white tears to get his defenses down. Two, she shot him in the face. Three, she was saved by the police even when she was in the wrong. Four, she threatened to expose James and ruin his life and career if he didn't do what she wanted. Five, she got powers that she didn't deserve and used them immediately to do evil. Six, white woman ultimate finishing move was that she was redeemed and coddled by the hero and told everything was going to be okay. So, you know, just fuck Olivia, honestly. I didn't really enjoy her character in this episode at all, on any level. And as much as I like James's conversation with Lena, I didn't like that the tension of the should he, shouldn't he deflated almost immediately afterwards with Tracy volunteering to give herself up. I'm like, what did we go through all of that good stuff for? And then now, you know, it's okay, you don't have to do it, you know? For an episode that was supposed to be centered around James, his part really only took up a third of the story and basically ended halfway through the episode. So it wasn't really it was a James featured story, but, like, if you compare it to Win story in 14, that was a Win story. Like, this is just a James featured episode. There's no, like, ticking clock, so to speak. And it would have been nice to at least get a shot of James at the end, maybe, like, looking at his helmet and then to the TV screen to Catco or something to show him contemplating it, still doing it anyway, because he had already gone through that conclusion that he inspired Tracy And, you know, that's what the storyline wanted him to do. But he had just reasoned that this was the best use of his platform to inspire all people. And then he just stops because he doesn't, like, Tracy gave herself up. Like, you know, kind of just, like, fell off after that.
Mm-hmm. Tati, so, yeah. What are your thoughts? What are your dislikes?
My thoughts are that is correct and that it doesn't make any sense. But I will go back to echoing Kara being an ass this episode. I don't really understand if the show like wants us to see how wrong she is or if it's an accident. Either way, it's dumb. Because like, why are you making your main character this unlikable? And if you're not doing it on purpose, then you're doing a really bad job of whatever it is you're trying to do. But considering that they keep having characters like Mon-El and James and John talk about how it's noble that she's keeping this secret, maybe, then I think that I'm supposed to believe Kara has a point. But she definitely does not have a point. Because Jessica already explained most of the reasons why she does not have a point. But I also just don't. Like I've already said, like, I don't believe in Kara and Lehman's friendship at this point. So the stakes are kind of low to me. Like, I don't really care if Lena forgives Supergirl or not. First off, because Lena still apparently is friends with Kara off screen. Like, James was just like, oh, but she was so happy to see you this morning in that scene that we didn't watch. So it's not like she's not losing anything. We're just not seeing it. And so it makes it even weirder to me that Kara is so stressed out about the fact that Lena doesn't like Supergirl because they didn't have a relationship before. It was just, Lena's in trouble. Supergirl saved her. And that's still gonna happen, even if Lena doesn't like Supergirl. So, like, nothing has changed other than Kara needing to interrupt, like, super important moments to be like, but we're friends, right? So, it's just stupid. I'm like, this is dumb. Everything about this is dumb. I also, like you've already pointed out, Jess, like, Lena is already a target for 300 things, right? Morgan Edge wasn't trying to come for her because she knows Supergirl. Anyone who doesn't like her mom or her brother isn't going to come for her because she knows Supergirl. So the fact that she knows Supergirl's identity, or doesn't, really, is a blip on the radar. No one's even asking about that. And considering that Supergirl wants to be friends with Lena, and she very desperately wants this, that means that people are going to come after Lena anyway. Like, there's no reason. So she's not even protecting Lena. The only person she could possibly be protecting is herself. Because the only way this works is if she's saying, I don't want Lena to under pressure break and give away that I am Supergirl. Because she's definitely going to be under pressure, even if she does not know who Supergirl is. So, yeah, it's not noble. It is selfish no matter what. And you can just say, I'm protecting my own identity, not I'm protecting Lena, because you're not protecting Lena. And again, if you're protecting your own identity from Lena, that just means you don't trust Lena the way exactly. That you do trust Wynn, that you do trust James, that you do trust everyone at the DEO. So,
that whatever. Is the point. Yes.
It's just dumb. I hate it. I hate this whole fight. And so that's why I can't even enjoy like Lena's comebacks, because I'm just like, well, yeah, that's true, but also let's just stop being friends now. Okay, yay, no more. Anyway, I also feel like, again, like Jessica already said this, but James's decision to turn himself in was cut short. And it's like, I feel like they're saving it for later, because why even tee it up at all if it's not going to go somewhere, you know? Right. And so it just kind of felt out of place in the rest of the episode. I don't know why, like, I guess I get it. Like, they let Mon-El go with her. So, like, obviously she wasn't going to be in danger, but I feel like it's more likely that James would not have let her do that. You know, like, if I was writing this character in my fanfic version of this episode, James would not have let her do that, and he would have added himself anyway. So I don't know. It was weird to me that he was just like, oh, okay, I guess we'll do it that way, even though he had come to peace with coming out. Like, at the very least, let her do that if that's what she wants, because, you know, agency, but also come out. You know? Like, I've decided that I should do this anyway, and then we can see what the fallout is next week or whatever week it's going to be.
Or if he's, like, in her ear, like, coaching her through it, instead of, I think, because Kara was doing that, like, saying it's going to be okay for her. But, like, if they had that through line of James continuing to, like, talk to her so that they were in this together, kind of.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I mean, because it did start with him, and Kara did come in and be like, I know Supergirl, too, but it's not really. it wasn't her story. So I agree with that. And I also thought that I would have liked some resolution with the police side of things, which would have, I'd probably tied into Garden Ripley itself, seeing how the police reacts to a black vigilante. But, like, it's probably asking too much of a Supergirl to have them confront institutionalized racism head on and then also try to resolve it in an episode. But I would have, you know, I don't know. I just thought thought it was strange that they were like, yeah, the police were totally going to shoot me. Anyway, moving on to next week, where we will still like police. But I also thought that, like, the conversation with Tanya and James focused specifically on black men. And I'm like, yeah, but black women also are in danger from police and other institutions. And in fact, on this very show, a police person named Alex was doing this exact same thing to a black woman named Julia. So I don't know why we did not acknowledge this. And I'm never going to get over it. All the time. I will always bring this up. In season 5, I'll be like, remember that time? So anyway. So I don't know. I thought she didn't have to be like, my brothers went through this. So right. I understand. You know, I was right. Like, all right. Finally, I really just want them to rip out the Band-Aid for Guillermo. Like, I agree with everything Jessica said. Like, you know, thank you, Monel, for being so noble, keeping your fifis a secret, and not putting Kara in a difficult position. But we know eventually she's going to be in that position. Otherwise, there's no point for the storyline. And right. As long as she isn't in that position, it's not her storyline. It's Monel's storyline, just hanging out in the background, being like, oh, so sad, because I love Kara. So I just want it to happen. And I, you know, just let it happen. Just let him tell her, and then them decide to do it or not do it. And I hope they don't do it, but if they do it, I will recognize that the council has made a stupid-ass decision, and I will ignore the decision. So, those are my dislikes.
I'll agree with you on the fact that they could showcase Kara and Lena's friendship more to make it, you know, to make the tension work better, because we haven't seen that for episodes, and that's really weird. So I will give you that, because it needs to happen. As much as I like the tension, I do want more buildup of it. For me, like we're coming up on 2 seasons of Lena being in the dark about Kara's secret identity. And there's only so much I can tolerate, because I'm tired. I'm tired of the whole, I need to protect her argument, because like you guys said, it's never made any sense. First of all, Kara, you know, as you both mentioned, she's not really trying to protect Lena. She's trying to protect herself. And the reason she is trying to protect herself, because deep down, the reason she doesn't want to tell her is because she doesn't trust her. And the reason she doesn't trust
she's
her
a loser.
Is because, right, exactly.
That,
not because
that,
of any other
but
reason.
That's insane.
Yes. So that is what ultimately going to break up their friendship, because Kara still doesn't believe Luthers can be good. And that is an issue with Lena, because that's been her whole plot line since the day she came on the show. So it's very frustrating. And I agree that Kara was being dense and kind of an asshole during this episode. And I dislike that she immediately went into attack mode when it came to what James told Lena, when she was the one who asked. And I feel like she's had a history of that at this point, because it just reminded me how harsh she can be sometimes with him for no reason. Like last season when he suited up and she found out about it, she was so angry. And her reasons for being angry sucked, just like they do now. And I also didn't really give a damn about Olivia for all the reasons Jess already mentioned. I barely remember her from earlier in the season, and I just want to say a big fat nope from me to Coville reappearing. This is not what I asked for. That storyline does nothing for me, and I'm annoyed he's become like the cockroach that just keeps surviving. He's worse than Edge. Edge used to keep appearing, and now he's no longer appearing, but Coville won't die. I did think that the episode should have started with James contemplating Guardian or being Guardian, and then moved into his speech before ending with him as well. Like, I feel like it would have come full circle, like you guys mentioned, and it would have rounded out the episode nicely and ensured that his plot was more central to the story. Instead, it was there, but it wasn't explored as much. Mm-hmm. And finally, I can't believe it's episode 19 and we're still dealing with Monel's feelings. Like, I think it's weird because now that Imra is gone, it seems like he didn't have as much regard for her as we thought in the beginning for the relationship. So the whole, did he need to be married thing, you know? And still nothing from Kara's end. So it's just starting to feel too one-sided for me, and I don't like it. Predictions. What do we predict for the next episode? Those were all my decisions.
That's
I didn't want to get too into Monel. Because that the fact that is, like you guys mentioned, like it does seem more just like his story and not anything having to do with her, because we haven't even gotten expressions from her about longing or like giving him looks or
anything. No, but we had like a whole first half of the season for her longing and all that other shit.
But so, he wasn't around.
At least his feelings are centered around Kara. I'm fine with that. Because it's, you know, like, cause she's the hero of the story, and she's supposed to be on that pedestal, and people are supposed to be like, oh, I love her, but I can't tell her, kind of thing. That's fine with me, honestly. What I didn't like is, like, the whole first half of the season with her chasing or mooning or being depressed about being single forever and not because he's gone and yeeted off into the sky for 7 years.
And now she doesn't seem to care. She's moved on. We're moving on to predictions.
What it's like when you walk out of the room and come back, and another thing.
In addition, though, predictions for next episode or for the rest of the season, what do we predict?
Well, I predict that Caramel's going to come to a head in the next episode, because they're going to be alone-y on their own-y off on a mission together. And, of course, there are things that we know about that mission that Jessica will talk about.
Yeah. Like, looking at the trailer and the preview episodes, we know that Allura's back and that she's alive and that a piece of Krypton has survived. And that's going to be, like, a shock to her system. So it's basically, like, Caramel go meet, like, Kara's mom on Krypton episode next week. And I feel like just for, in general, on that episode, all her life, like, Kara thought that she didn't even have a home to go back to. And lo and behold, there's a piece of Krypton that still exists. So, of course, she still has to beat, like, the big bad for the season and all that kind of stuff. But it does open up the question of what's next for her. Like, once Rey's defeated, which home matters more? Like, her real home on Krypton with her mother that she hasn't seen all her life? Or her adopted one on Earth with the DEO, John, Alex, James, Wynn, and all of her friends that she's made, like, a life from? And then, I guess, like, tangentially, like, Superman, Kal-El, over in Metropolis, it's kind of the same question that we'll never get to see because this is not his story. Mm-hmm. But I just thought it was kind of an interesting kind of concept. So I expect that to be weighing heavily on her in the, like, in the back of her mind, which should also lead to some pretty emotional scenes with Alex about whether she should stay or she should go.
Oh, I like that.
I agree with this. And I feel like it will, ironically, parallel Mon-El last season. When he had the choice between Daxam and Earth, and he chose Earth, so Kara will also choose Earth.
If this gives me more Kara Alex scenes, I'm okay. I'm okay with it. It's good. I'm going to take a quick break to go pee, and I'll be right back.
And I will definitely leave that in.
Moving on to Krypton. Lyta and Drew Zod are busy looking for Seg after Brainiac decides now's the time to completely take over Kandor. They find Seg and Nissa, and Drew asks Seg to take him back to the Fortress of Solitude because he believes the only way to stop Brainiac is to bring back Val-El, who is apparently still alive and stuck in the Phantom Zone, and no longer... he's not going to be a hologram anymore. Drew explains that he must go into the Phantom Zone itself in order to get Val and bring him back, and what could seem like a few minutes to everyone on Krypton could be years in the Phantom Zone. Drew comes back with Val moments later. Nissa and Lyta head back to Kandor without telling Seg. Seg tells Val they're up against Brainiac and he seeks his help. Val's like, no, I can't help you. You're all dead. Later, Seg finds out that Drew's plan all along was to use Val to strike a deal with Brainiac where he would take Val and rule the whole universe if he allowed Drew to rule over Krypton, and Brainiac will have all of Val's knowledge. Meanwhile, Dev wakes up in surprise. He's got a bionic arm now, which is fine because it means we get more Dev and he is not dead. He walks to what looks like the Sagittari locker room, only to find that they've basically given up and are trying to run away from Brainiac and out of the city. That's when Lyta comes in and takes command and gives them one hell of a speech, then sends them all off to fight Brainiac. She's full of sadness and regret later when she realizes they all died in the fight and seeks comfort from Dev. Elsewhere, Nissa has escaped with her fake baby when she's confronted with Jaxxer and is basically blamed for helping to ruin Krypton society with her father. But wait, there's more. Jaxxer explains that when Nissa was a child, she was in an accident so bad that her mom died, but then she was okay enough that they can remove her subconscious into one of her clone bodies. Dun dun dun. Dev and Lyta try to escape when they freeze as Brainiac takes over the city. Zod takes Brainiac to the Fortress of Solitude, but Seg refuses to let him take his grandfather. Seg draws Brainiac close enough and opens up the Phantom Zone, and he's sucked in. Unfortunately for Seg, his victory is short-lived because Brainiac sucks him into the Phantom Zone as well. While Krypton is safe, a hop to 1 month into the future of Kandor, and Drew is now ruling over Krypton with Lyta and Dev looking uneasy by his side, while Jaxar and Nyssa find Val-El. Drew is making everyone a Sagittari, and Adam is still stuck somewhere. We don't know. Superman's cape is now a Zod cape instead, and that is what you missed on Krypton. What did we like about this episode?
I like how fast that recap was.
Yeah, that was impressive.
We didn't like anything.
Oh, me first? Okay, I guess I'll go first. All right, so I like that Seg had a plan. That he executed the plan, and then that he mostly succeeded with the plan, with the exception of, you know, dying himself or getting sent to the
like, he only went through, like, half of Litter's smart school.
Yeah, exactly. He did not have to throw away the plan, because he threw himself away. He threw a whole seg away. So anyway, I have never been prouder of my useless son, so this was his shining moment. I did, like, he saved the people of Kandor by getting them out. And was very heroic in that. And then he actually managed to stop Brainiac. For now. I don't know how long it'll last. But yes, incredible show stopping. Never before seen. Quite literally. I have never before seen Seg be as successful as he was in this episode. I'm also glad the Val-El hologram finally served a purpose. And the real Val-El can finally stand up. Even though he was much lamer than the hologram. And much more useless. But that's okay. That's how it goes. I also love Lyta and Dev's mutual support for each other. I love that dynamic. That friendship makes me so happy. And I really enjoyed seeing her stepping up to lead the Sagittari again. And also, you know, it was heartbreaking, but in a good way to see her sort of like be vulnerable and have that regret over losing soldiers. Speaking of which, the phone call between Seg and Lyta was nice because it really gave that sense that like, oh, everything's, you know, like, things are forgiven between them because what really matters is that they're both okay. They're both alive because they love each other and they're always going to love each other regardless of what circumstances are. And I liked how even though she was really upset that she, you know, wanted, she gave that big speech and then they all died anyway, it did help the people escape, right? It gave a distraction so that the people of Kandor could escape. So they really actually literally served their purpose. Yay. Also, Jaxar is much more likable and interesting when she's not just, like, torturing people that I already don't like that much. Huh. So yay. Yay for Jaxar. I liked her reveal to Nyssa. I thought it was interesting. Like, from her point of view, it's poignant and it's, you know, sad that her life's work was taken from her and then utilized for a purpose that she did not want. Like, she wanted to help everyone in Krypton eradicate disease or be able to fight disease better for everyone in Krypton. Instead, it's just being used by society's elite to cheat death. So, yes, that sucks for you, Jax. And that's what I liked on Krypton.
Like, I think it's kind of funny how I think all of us, we are in agreement that Seg had the strongest episode in terms of heroism. And then, two, that this happens in the season finale. And, like, you know, it took all season for him to get to this point. And then afterwards, he's promptly sucked into the Phantom Zone. It's like, well, there goes that. Yeah. Being a hero, Seg. I've said before that I think Seg is actually a pretty decent strategist. Like, he does have plans and good ideas. He just doesn't have any of the charisma or follow through to have people execute his plans. And, like, he still wasn't quite as inspirational as maybe his grandson would be, considering that both Lyta and Nyssa didn't do what he said at all and snuck back to Kandor without him knowing. And his son just basically was like, fuck you, Dad! And went off and sent, like, his grandfather to, like, a monster. But, you know, hey! Like, his conviction to, you know, like, he's not there yet, but, you know, step in the right direction. Like, his conviction to rescue as many people in Kandor as he could, including his grandfather, I thought was very L-esque of him. And the show finally remembered his background as a scam artist and made that into good use in order to trick, like, a 12th-level intellect. Like, is he really a 12th-level intellect if he got tricked into a platform so he'd be sucked into the Phantom Zone? Like, really, Brainiac? But it worked for Seg, so yay, Seg. I also loved Leiter's resolve, like, as much as I think in this episode Seg embodied the best attributes of House L in the finale, I think Leiter embodied the moral code of House Zod. If she hadn't shot her mother in the previous episode, I'm sure Jaina would have been proud of her. Leiter being able to, like, round up fleeing Sagittarii and carry out a destroy mission with a clear plan and goals just kind of underscores what I was saying last episode about how her absence in Seg and Nissa's team up last week was the exact reason why it failed. Like, these people were ready to bail. Like, Dev couldn't even get them to, like, listen to him. And then she shows up, and then everybody's, like, on board immediately. Speaking of Dev, he's alive, so that's great news. And he has a new mechanical arm, so he's got, like, a nice little blade. I got a little bit of what I mentioned in my predictions last week about the parallel of the square, with Dev being emotional support for Leiter and then them growing closer, although I think it could have gone a little farther, which I'll mention in my dislikes or non-likes. Basically, I think that's
just non-likes.
It's not like a dislike. It's like a little bit lighter than a dislike. It's just like a non-like kind of thing. Even with, like, Leiter emotionally opening herself up to Dev, I also liked the fact that no matter the weirdness between them, Seg was still adamant about Leiter not going into Kandor because he wanted to protect her. I don't know how that sentence made sense when I wrote it, but I also liked the fact that no matter what the weirdness between them, Seg was still adamant about Leiter not going into Kandor because he wanted to protect her. And I liked their little intercom conversation. Even though it interrupted Dev and Leiter's moment, I thought it was kind of, as part of the love square thing, that Seg had to interrupt them, even though he didn't know.
It was poetic.
Yeah. Saying how much that he wanted her to get out and be safe as quickly as possible. So that triangle is working, for sure. then I agree with Patsy that Jax Her's backstory about the clones is compelling, despite her having to carry the load of her screen partner in addition to her own. I like that scene mainly because of Jax.
Likes.
The shade. Likes. Okay. Yes, I agree. We are all in agreement. Seg was actually a hero this episode, and it actually worked, and I was shocked. I feel like I've complained about him being a little lost during the season and not having any feelings about much, except now he has many feelings about Drew and stopping Brainiac, and it actually paid off, which is nice, so I was very proud. Leiter got some great stuff during this episode as well, and I was so happy. And I liked that one of the Sagittarii mentioned her mom, and we got to see her look of remorse about what happened with Jaina briefly. And I love that she came to lead them into battle, and her speech gave me goosebumps. Like, it was so good. I would have followed her right off right out there too. Then she got to have a moment with vulnerability with Dev, and it really showed that even though the Sagittarii are trained for battle, she doesn't see them as dispensable either. Yeah, she and Dev are really good together, and I really like that she opened up to him and that he was there for her. I think that they've been shown to truly care for each other, and it's in these quiet moments that it's most prevalent. And I also like that Leiter and Seg kind of made up over the phone, which was really good since he was going to disappear, and I would have been really salty if they just left it on bad terms.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I was like, wait, he can't disappear, and they're just mad at each other, right? Finally, Jaxer's speech made an impact because it's obvious that she was very proud of her work, and she never wanted it to be used for the reasons it was used for, which was to save the elite and not anybody else. But what did we not like?
What did I not like? Okay. I thought that the line delivery of the whole, like, this is the society that you helped your father create was, like, so great. But then I, like, sit back and I think about it and I'm like, what? We haven't seen this society or Nissa's role in creating it. So it really loses a lot of its impact, IMO. If we had gotten to see, like, if Krypton started a little bit earlier, like, where we saw what the society used to be and what the fuck Darren Vex made of it, then that would mean something to me, you know? But instead I'm just like, okay, well, this society's kind of lame, but so are lots of societies. And also I don't see the society or, like, see the people or, like, know how they're oppressed. I just know that the rankless, like, the way that you treat the rankless sucks, but everyone else, like, no one else has a better idea for the rankless, which will bring me to the later, you know, that'll bring me to later. Like, I haven't seen what it used to be like, and so it's kind of dumb to me. Like, I'm like, all right, I don't really know. It's been a full season, and I don't really know what makes Kryptonian society tick, or what makes it worse than other societies,
or what makes it worse than it used to be. All right. In leading into the final moments, things are now worse. Thank you, Druzod. Especially for the rankless. Like, now the rankless have to be conscripted into the Sagittarii. Like, is that superior? I don't understand. Do they like this? And so Zod is basically, like, dear leader. But how did that happen? How are we there? Well, he's, like, a totally random person, right? Did he come in and say, hello, I am a Zod from the future, and I'm going to do this? That seems unlikely, because it used to be punctual by death to even talk about how there are aliens. So I feel like they also didn't die on time travel. So I don't know. I don't understand how he's here and how he got to the position he's in and why everyone's listening to him and Dev and Lyta just have to sit back and, like, you know, blank face each other when they could just incapacitate him or shoot him because he's not a superhuman here on Krypton. He's just a regular human. Sorry, a regular Kryptonian, just like everyone else, without special powers. So I don't understand why he's here and how he got there. Okay. And I also don't like that it seems like Nyssa and Jax are mounting some kind of resistance with Val. Like, I don't know what they're doing, but they're over on one side, and Lyta and Dev are over there with Zod. And I was like, I don't like this! And I know, well, I guess this is kind of a, this is a prediction, but I'm just gonna say, I know that by the end of, like, the first episode of season 2, they will all be the one big happy Team Krypton again. So I don't like that in the meantime I have to sit around and pretend like Lyta and Dev aren't doing anything. Also, I don't like that Cam and Adam just silently appeared for one scene. Like, I feel no resolution for this. I don't understand. Cam should have been around for Seg disappear, or, like, have feelings about Seg disappearing. I don't understand. Why is my son being treated this way? And then Adam, like, where was he? Why was he there? Who was that girl? Why are my questions not being answered? Why did you show me that random scene with that random girl if you're not even going to mention it in the finale?
Yeah. I think first, to answer your Zod question and, like, the why the people, do they like it or not, I feel like in the beginning they probably will. Like, the rankless being scripted into the Sagittarii, I probably feel like this is a step up for them because they get to learn how to fight and all that kind of stuff. But I, like, this will go into my predictions later, but it will not, it will quickly, like, devolve from that. And then, like, I don't think Adam is back for sure, but I'm wondering if Ron or wherever he got transported back to was bottled in this altered timeline, and that's why he can't get out, because he's stuck in a bubble now, or it's going to be hard realizing that he's been stuck in a bubble or something like that. But, like, same as Tazi, I did feel uneasy with Zod's new rule, and the fact that even though Brainiac was defeated, all the worlds that he bottled up have not been released, and now Zod is demanding loyalty or else. And for some reason, Lyta and Dev are like, okay. And supporting it for now. Like, I too want to know, like, who lost that rock, paper, scissors fight that got to be, like, the new leader of Krypton and not also, someone actually
have from they that explained house. Like, to everyone who he is? Like, are they like, well, this is my no, son from so. The future?
I just think that they're... know him as Black Zero. Like, him and Jax are made that deal a couple of episodes back about the power vacuum, and I guess since she's got her Varro protocol, like, he gets the Krypton by default or something like that. I don't know. I don't think it'll ever be explained exactly who he is, but yeah. I just, you know, like, in terms of leadership, I feel like Lyta should be,
right?
You know, she's the highest ranking military, if it's a military coup, she's the highest ranking military, so I don't really, you know, understand how she got to that point. I think that there's a missed opportunity for a clone granddad instead of real granddad. Like, I get that they used it to his disappearance into the Phantom Zone to introduce the Phantom Zone, but, like, who voluntarily sends himself to the Phantom Zone, to be honest? And I want to know, like, how did he find it? And why did he build something capable of transporting himself there? You know, all these questions need answers.
But did it, I mean, for the Phantom Zone, wasn't it someone from Krypton who made it as a jail to just send people to? Or
do we know that at this point? Like, I guess
they don't, I don't think they discuss it on the show. Like, I guess we're not supposed to know it, but I mean, I know that some Krypton.
But we do know that Druzod was exiled there, right?
So, like, the Phantom Zone, like, obviously became a thing, but I'm talking about, like, chronology, because I feel like there's, you know, again, with, like, the El Zod combo seal guarding, like, Doomsday. Mm-hmm. Obviously, El Zod had to create that. It was probably somehow Lyta and Zeg some kind of weird way in the timeline, but none of that, like, chronology, like the Genesis Chamber and how that became the default baby making chamber.
Right.
None of that, like, really explained very well. So is the Phantom Zone, like, Val-El's creation, and that he just, you know, it, none of that is, like, really
clear. And if he doesn't create it, wouldn't they just wouldn't say, I'll just come back?
Or, I don't know, like...
Right, like, he would have had to know about it from before to build the contraption to get himself out of it at some point.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, so how did he find out about it? Did he create it? Like, how did, like,
yeah, why say?
They said that he has the ability to see all of time for some reason, and I also didn't get that. That should be a dislike, too. I didn't understand how he was doing that.
In the Phantom Zone.
Like, yeah.
Anyone can do that in the Phantom Zone? Because they made it sound like just him could do that.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, I think that everyone can, because at this point...
You get more and more access to, like, all the, like, things in the Phantom Zone. I don't know.
I feel like they're trying to make the Phantom Zone like the Speed Force, in which, like, everyone can see all of time at any given point.
I feel like for Krypton, as a show in general, they throw in a lot of comic book things that if you are not actually a comic book fan, you have no idea what the fuck is going on. Like, Adam's, like, going when he was... being transported back to Ron, like, I doubt very many people that did not know who Adam Strange was in the comics knew what was going on in the episode. And so I feel like they throw out things that are really, you know, nice, like, comic things that you recognize, but only if you read the comics. So I, like, introduced Phantom Zone, but really don't explain, like, where it came from or how or why it came to be. Moving on, the love square dynamic that I mentioned was a little bit lopsided. Like, I like that we got Dev and Lyta to offset Zeg and Nissa, but the Dev and Lyta was not, didn't move forward as much as they moved forward Zeg and Nissa in the episode before. Like I said, like, I feel like once they became unfrozen from Brainiac and they almost survived, like, it was like a life or death experience, that she goes up to him, but then she, like, puts her head down and, like, hugs him instead of, like, kissing him. I was like, well, that was a missed opportunity. And then still, and they're still moving forward with Zeg and Nissa, on the other hand, which I don't really like. The whole, like, cuddle in the snow and, you know, all huddled up or whatever. And, like, Nissa's, like, cocky remarks continue. And, like, I just, at one point, I really wish Druzad had threatened to throw her into the Phantom Zone. Like, and then Nissa only agreed to help Lyta to go save her designer baby, which I still don't believe how she's so attached to this baby, because I don't believe how she can be so madly in love with Zeg right now. They didn't really, she went from 0 to 100, like, almost immediately, and there was no reason for her to have felt, like, Zeg gave her no reason to fall in love with him several episodes into the season until he saved her, but she had already, like, supposedly fallen in love with him before that, so it really just does not make any sense. I thought it was really dumb when she pulled out a gun on a robot as if it were a person. And I thought it was dumb that actually works. I was like, this is stupid. Like, you don't pull a gun out on a robot. Like, what is that supposed to do to the robot? You know? And then, like, the DNA baby aside, which I have massive problems with in terms of what it means for the show, and I'll get into that shortly, I think it was difficult to get through the clone talk. The story, like, itself, like, Jack Sauer telling the story was intriguing, compelling, but watching, like, Wallace try to, like, struggle emote to show that Nisha's was in shock was not compelling to me. Like, she's been a one-note character all season, and then this new question is basically being set to give her a new storyline in season 2, and probably, like, rewrite her entire character, and I just, like, I don't even care about her now, and so I shudder to think about the implications of why the writers want the audience to be more sympathetic to Nissa than they are, and see her as a victim of a father instead of a power player with her father. I think there's a lot of implications about that whole sex scene getting sucked into the Phantom Zone that makes me questioning where exactly the show thinks it's going with this mythology. It was already established that Zod, not Brainiac, was the anomaly that needed to be defeated to save Superman, but the cape returned as soon as Brainiac got sucked into the Phantom Zone. So, you know, I don't really understand that part. And then Zeg gets sucked into the Phantom Zone, the cape changed from El to Zod. So, like, here lies in my problem. It only changed to Zod after Zeg disappeared. Then that can mean that Lyta's pregnant now, but Zeg wasn't able to conceive Jor-El, which in that case, Korra Bex is definitely not Jor-El. But then again, Zod said in the original timeline that Zeg got bottled into Kandor, So in that case, both Jor-El and Druzhah to have been born anyway, Lyta would still have to be pregnant when she escaped. And if Nissa also escaped with her DNA baby, then that would strongly suggest that Korvex is Jor-El. Right. And, like, I just cannot see, like, Nissa and Lyta ever being close enough, even after Seg's supposed, you know, quote-unquote death being bottled, to have their sons be BFFs growing up. Plus, the way that the writers have treated Nissa as a character up until this point, you can start to understand, like, my headache and the stomach queasiness about, you know, how this all is supposed to make sense.
See, that whole explanation just, I'm confused all over again.
Right, exactly.
And for me, like Tati mentioned, the whole Kryptonian society, I feel like what was a missed opportunity was that Seg started off, his family had rank, right? And then he became a rankless. So I feel like they should have used him as a bridge between the two to kind of show us like how it differs from him when he was younger. Like we could have flashed back to his life when he was, when he had rank, and then to his life when he didn't.
Exactly.
But the entire time he spends, after his parents died, which he barely got glossed over, was that he didn't really hang out with anybody except Kamen, and then only when he needed to like speak with him, and it was always like caves or he got caught. So we never saw him interact with anybody in the society.
And he has to have other family members. Right. Like, it can't have just been his parents and his grandfather. Like, his mother's side of the family should probably still be ranked people that we could have seen and distinguish, but oh well.
Yeah, so it just makes no sense. So I feel like that was a major missed opportunity. And I honestly saw no point at all in them showing glimpses of Adam in the world that he was in, that Brainiac created, if he wasn't even going to do anything except look around in shock. So why didn't we see him interact with that woman he saw? Why didn't he like try to investigate what was really going on rather than just like moving through the crowd? It just didn't need to be there unless they were actually going to do something with it. And while I felt bad about Jaxer having her work ripped away from her, I feel like the Nissa clone story would have had more impact if we'd gotten to know her better. I know she mentioned before to her father that she gave up on her ambitions and friends, but since we never actually saw that, her discovery of being cloned fell flat. And it's also the first time we learned she has sisters, and I was just scratching my head and thinking about her character who exists, but we know nothing about what really drives her.
You know what else would have been good for that clone story, for that clone story to actually have an impact? If Nissa was, in fact, a power player, like, if we had seen her, like, move on her own and think that she was doing shit all the way up through that and then discover that she's, like, a clone, that would have been a bigger impact than her following her dad around and just being in love with Seg and, oh, but no, I'm a clone, you know, kind of thing.
Right.
Like, in Legends of Tomorrow with Ava, and she was, like, a boss for all this, the whole season, and then finds out that she's not even an original, and that was like a huge impacting moment for her. But with this one, it's just kind of like they just needed a story for Nissa, and they needed a way to include like the clones in season two.
Right. I mean, I was like, okay, she's a clone. I guess that's fine. We're gonna go with that. And I low-key thought that Jaxer was going to reveal that she was Nissa's mom. And I won't lie, I was disappointed that that wasn't the case, because I feel like that would have made sense and also given Nissa some kind of connection to the overall fight against Brainiac, but they didn't do that.
It sounded so personal when she told Darren, like, you betrayed me or whatever.
And yeah, I was it like, really did.
You betrayed me, my husband, but no.
They don't want to do these things and give her, like, any kind of backstory that would actually make sense.
So at least we spared, like, a Nissa Jaxer, Jaina, Lyta parallel competition thing, so that's not happening.
That's true. There are a certain, like, there is a limit to, like, the secret fathers and sons and mothers and daughters that you can have in one series, so I guess it's okay.
Yeah, and even more impactful had it been, like, did her dad die? He's still alive.
He's still alive.
Yeah, so had he admitted, be like, oh, yes, and, like, you were a clone, then she'd be like, oh, you know, my dad just said that I'm not his real daughter, or, like, the way that she was born, or whatever. I don't know. Anyway, and I...
Because he knew that he could, like, reclone her.
Right. Just really creepy. And and just in general, I still don't understand Nissa's desperation, like Jess said, to save her and Seg's child. Like, she ditched Seg and didn't bother following up with him. So I'm not confident that she actually cares about him at all. Like, okay, well, you're gone. He was the one who was on the comm, like, oh, Nissa, where are you? And she's just like, I'm gone. Whatever. So her characterization just throws me off because it's not consistent. And I agree. I also dislike that it made it seem like Lyta and Dev were okay working under Drew's rule, even though it was clear that he seemed to rule like a dictator, you know, the way he was talking. And if it's just going to be Nyssa, Jaxxar, and Valel in the rebellion to stop Drew, then I'm not really here for it. And I feel like I would just give up the show if that was the case.
Yeah. Or Dana came back and only helped Jaxxar and Valel and Nyssa against Lyta. No. I would not like
that
there.
That would make me so mad. Okay. I'm not going to think about it. Moving into predictions. What do we think is going to happen in season two now that we know the show has been picked up?
Well, I feel like Adam will somehow figure out how to get his people. His people. We'll see his people. And then we'll figure out how to get his people out of Brainiac's thingy-ma-bummer. And then save Zeg. I assume he'll save Zeg. Unless Val does it. No, because Val's thing got destroyed. So it'll be Adam. That way he can finally be useful. And I don't think that Lyta's already pregnant. So I assume that time just knows that Zeg is not really dead. And that's why Drew can still exist. Even though he should have already been born in the alternate timeline, and therefore he should not exist. But I don't know how Krypton uses time travel. So they obviously have a newfangled method of time travel that is something else. And obviously Drew's out will be the big bad of season two. And then I assume that once they defeat him in real time, or send him back to Earth or whatever, that's when Lyta will be pregnant. And she'll be like, oh, well, this is kind of awkward. Do I want this child?
I need to raise my son better.
So, yeah, exactly. Okay. I have no feelings on Corvex and whether or not he is Jor-El. I have no idea. I'm not even going to touch it. All right.
Yeah, there you Jess go. Is going to get more into that, but I feel like since Zeg is now in the Phantom Zone and him being there caused Superman's cape to be replaced with Juzod's cape, I feel like it might mean that Jor-El isn't Nyssa and Seg's son, or else he would still be alive as a baby in the egg-shaped contraption she was carrying around. So, it could be that
Seg... Or her baby's not making it, I guess.
Yeah, that too, yeah. So, it could be that Seg being stuck in the Phantom Zone means no more Els, but since we know he'll be getting out, it could very well mean that he meets Jor-El's mom while in the Phantom Zone.
Yeah, and I have a different, slightly more pessimistic take on it, because... In this timeline, like, Drew is the general, which means no matter who Nyssa's baby turns out to be, Corvex, Jor-El, or some other, you know, random person, they would never be able to rise to power in the first place, and would probably have a completely different life in which Kal-El is still never born. Mm-hmm. So if it is Jor-El, then Jor-El is not going to rise to whatever rank he was initially in the previous timeline, and therefore, you know, that could still happen, but I prefer your take on it much more that it's not Jor-El. Because part of me definitely feels like they're hyper-focusing on the mystery of Corvex simply because it's not Jor-El. So it's like another Josiel baby red herring kind of situation where they're saying, like, they're throwing all this stuff about, you're supposed to, like, look at Corvex as being Jor-El, but in the end, it's not Jor-El at all. It's just, like, some random normal baby or... not a baby. So
it's like a dragon that's living inside the egg.
I hope that it is one of the things that they definitively answer with regard to Corvex in season two, because I don't need it really drawn out. And the moment that it becomes apparent that is their plan, then there's no point in me watching my NOTP come to fruition so that I can just finally, like, let go. So I feel like there's only so long that they can, like, tease that out. And I think for season two, maybe spending some time in the Phantom Zone also probably gives Zeg time to see, like, a multitude of futures/AUs. One of which he's probably, you know, living happily ever after with Lyta, and Drew doesn't grow up to be an asshole. And, you know, on the opposite side, unfortunately, probably one with Nyssa, whatever the fuck Corvex turns out to be. And or... whatever future produces Jor-El and Kal-El, so at least he knows, like, who, like, his future grandson comes from. Because I feel like that would play a lot into his determining which way that he should go with his life, kind of thing. I hope Adam saves Zeg by himself, because I like that much more than the dynamic that they set up in the finale with Nyssa on the hero side and with Val and Lyta and Dev supporting the villain. Doomsday is loose, and since you can't kill him, you're probably going to have to throw him in the Phantom Zone, too. So maybe that's how they get Seg out, in which case, then I would hope Lyta is, like, heavily involved in that storyline. And then also, Brainiac's bubbles are still around, so one of my predictions, I think, because Drew will continue to bottle worlds that don't submit to his rule, which is what will cause Lyta to finally see her son as, like, see the monster behind the man. And get her on board with, like, overthrowing him.
Mm-hmm. All excellent. Lots of theories.
You've given the Krypton so much more thought than...
Yes. I've given you the season two, the bones of season two. This is what we're going to do. Right.
She's a writer breaking the story. All right. Moving on to Flash, before we get into the plot, do you guys want to read the feedback?
No, I hate feedback. And those who give it.
JK. I know that we did have a question from Ivy, and that's like what I clung to. She's asking if we think Keenan is going to be back on Flash, basically, for season 5.
I think that that's a really tough one, because they didn't really give, like, the way that they had him talk about it in the finale really made it feel like it could go either way. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe they did not know themselves at that point. And the way that he is not being promoted for Legends also makes me feel like it could go either way. So, yeah, it's really up in the air for me. What do you guys think?
I don't think that that's in the plans, at least to, like, make him a regular. I know at least they're going to have to do some flashbacks in episode 1, because they're probably going to do the 6-month jump forward, so mm-hmm. they're going to have like rewind to see what the fallout was from Nora announcing herself. I feel like they have to do some flashbacks to at least explain the fallout from her appearance. So Keenan will at least shoot one episode of The Flash, but seeing as how they're going to have Jessica and they're going to have Hartley now, I don't see there being a whole lot of room to add him back as well as a regular. But I don't really know what that means for him in Legends either.
Yeah, right. I mean, I remember posting to Twitter, I was like, not to be an alarmist, but Wally isn't on the poster for season 4 of Legends, and that really concerned me, and he's not listed in the description either mm-hmm. for that the CW press release. I agree that in the finale it could go either way. I don't think he's going to be back as a regular. If he does come back in any capacity, it could be like Jess said, whether they do a time, for me, if I don't personally think that they're going to do a time jump. I hope that they won't really, not that I don't think that they will. But regardless, in the first episode, whether they flash back or not, it's present time, he's still going to have to be in there. And that's why I agree with that. And I think that he could pop in a few times, but I don't think that they're going to focus on him now that they have Hartley either, unfortunately, because it should be Wally, and that's what pisses me off.
Right.
But
I do think it's more likely that he'll just make appearances.
Yeah.
And I think that that's still going to be stemming from the same reason that King left in the first place last season. So yeah, he may come in from time to time, but even if he doesn't come back to Legends, I agree that it's more likely he won't come back full time to Flash.
Yeah. And I think Worst case scenario is that he doesn't come back to either.
That's definitely the worst case scenario. But like Jessica said, we have to assume that at the very least, he will need to be in the first episode mm-hmm. for flashbacks.
Yeah.
Or to start from, you know. Unless we're like, oh, well, Wally had another mission. Let's continue our conversation. Ooh. Sorry, we were interrupted, you know.
Yeah, basically.
Which I guess they could do. But we do have other feedback as well. So we've got one from Latonia, who had to be honest that the news that Ralph Dibny is back for season 5 soured all thoughts of the finale. She can't even remember how Devo died or how he came back. And so she thought it was a lackluster villain for a lackluster finale for a lackluster season. But she did like Wally being back and that the mystery girl was Nora, even though it was super obvious unless you are delusional. She did not believe Caitlin could be an OBGYN. Maybe she did it that 2 times in med school. I don't know. Is that something you do in med school? That's what she said. She said she tried it twice in med school. So there's that. But despite her negativity, she did want to end things in a more hopeful manner. So she hopes for more CSI Barry and a journalist Iris team-ups next season. More development with Cisco. And
Wally gets to be involved because there's supposed to be family as a theme, and he is family. So, yes. And finally she said, huh?
Literally family.
Yes, literally. And she ended with, you ladies are great. Can't wait to hear your thoughts. Aww. And you too are great. And thank you for your thoughts, which we will reproduce in full on our Tumblr, ladieswgumption.tumblr.com. We also got some feedback from Tanika, who seemed a lot happier with this episode than she has with previous ones. So, yay. She said she loved the episode and is very excited, which is, that makes me excited. I love that. She loved Barry saying, it's you and me, Iris. Yes. I love a ship, is what she said. Also, she liked Marlies winning against Clifford and that there was still a nice amount of time to explore fun things after Clifford was defeated. Obviously, she loved Nora helping her daddy, even though it still means Barry can't do anything without help.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But we'll ignore that.
We accept help from the daughter. It's fine.
That's right. It's still part of him. It's fine. She loved Nora's reveal and that Sisko was actually useful with his powers because we had been deprived of him and his powers a lot in season 4. She thought the Cecile and Caitlin Frost interaction was actually interesting and that she's actually kind of excited for her storyline in season 5. That's pretty, that's impressive. I like that. She did not like that Ralph is back, but he wasn't as annoying to her in this episode, so that's good. She's sad Marlies is leaving, understandable. And she wishes to go and put up more of a fight. Yeah, he was kind of like, oh, I defeated, I didn't think about this. This is not one of the top possibilities I contemplated. I'm melting. That's what it was like. And then he was like, I'm back, bitches. And I was like, no, you're not fine.
That's all it took. Anyway, technology was the death of him.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was ironic, actually.
Also, how can Marlies use the teleportation device if technology is failing? It's magic, okay? It's magic, not technology. But anyway, she also had some questions. Do we think that Nora will be the mother of Bart and Jenna will be Jenny? Or do we think that they will follow the comics more closely?
Oh,
yes. I think this is based on the idea that they won't do the twins, but
they're going to do the twins.
Gotta do the twins. They're not going to make Nora be a single mom who gives her son her last name. Dawn must exist so Bart can exist. Yeah. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I'm just saying they're not going to do that. Just for the record.
Right, yes. The Flash won't do that.
And yeah, I do think that Jenna will be who Jenny is named for, though. Because probably Nora and Jenna will be very close in age and will be friends and, you know, so.
Yeah, I can see that. But I do think that the twins are still going to exist and Nora is one of the twins. They just changed her name, Dawn and Nora, so everybody can, you know.
And then lied to us.
Yeah.
That they weren't thinking about doing the twins right now, but
whatever.
Yes, we don't believe you, Todd. Whatever.
Exactly.
the other twin, but he does exist.
Yes. Exactly. She thought it was a great finale to an underwhelming season, and that Todd should just co-write every episode.
The final one's from Aaron?
Yes. The final one is from Aaron, who is lovely. Says hello to us, lovely ladies. We're all lovely.
Hi,
we are
Aaron.
Having a wonderful day. Aaron, thank you. And he said, Nora Allen has been adopted by us all.
Yes.
This is her own.
Protect her.
Our daughter's so powerful. But yes, her two scenes made the episode worth it. And the best part of the episode was her reversing time to destroy the satellite. Which reminds me of that, someone tweeted like, oh, Barry's dying from the satellite. And then Nora, and then the poster from Click, you know, the Adam Sandler movie, Click. Rewind time. But yes, he thought the finale was decent aside from that. Not the best one, but also not the worst. Iris and Marlies' crack ship. Yes. Marlies is wonderful. It was amazing. Hopefully we see her again. I agree with that. Neil was incredible, but they didn't use him correctly. I agree with that. He thought 4A worked better than 4B. Also something I agree with. But Josiel and baby Jenna are adorable. And she's gonna be talking in 5 months. I guess we'll come back and she'll just be talking. There you go. Wally was great. And that he's looking forward to the Barry Iris Nora dynamic, which I am definitely looking forward to as well. He's very mad, along with me, at Todd for lying. That's why I divorced him. I totally understand you, Aaron. We won, but at what cost? Yes. That's also true. It's a very long email, but a very beautiful email. And thank you for this wonderful podcast. As always, love Ladies with Gumption. And even though his shows are done, he looks forward to the Super Bowl podcast and the Hiatus podcast. You're so nice, Aaron. Thank you for listening, even when you don't care. We love you. All right. The rest of all of the feedback will be put on our lovely Tumblr, including all of Ivy's feedback, which will be glorious and that you will want to read.
Yes, so thank you for all of that. We always appreciate it. But don't think that we're not going to be back, because we will. We have several subjects we're going to discuss over Hiatus plus Supergirl. Flash recap. Barry is still shocked after DeVoe hacked the Star Lab satellite. Cisco asks him what they're going to do, and Barry says he doesn't know until Iris walks in with Marlies, and she comes up with a Hail Mary plan to take down DeVoe by suggesting Barry enter his mind to try and find whatever good might still exist. Meanwhile, Cecile has already gone into labor, but they try to hold off on her having the baby because their plan involves her using the cerebral inhibitor to send Barry's mind into DeVoe's. Sorry, Cecile, you can't even have your baby in peace. Barry enters DeVoe's mind using his thinking cap, all while still being tethered to the real world, and he has up until the satellite reaches 100% to stop DeVoe and his plan. Inside DeVoe's mind, Marlies advises him to avoid the thinker at all costs, but to go back through her and Clifford's greatest hits. She's saddened to learn that Clifford's essentially erased Marlies from his mind. Not too long after that, Ralph shows up and Barry's happy to see him. Ralph is still alive because apparently DeVoe is using his body, and if he died, so would DeVoe. In an Inception-like battle, Barry and Ralph take on multiple DeVoes following the realization that the good part of the thinker is dead. Ralph tells Barry to think of something he loves. For Ralph, that's an assortment of food, and for Barry, that's Iris. It's enough to power him through, and he defeats DeVoe and then comes up with a plan to drag Ralph through the vortex out of DeVoe's mind so that they can defeat him in the real world. When Barry and Ralph emerge, DeVoe appears and essentially dies, but wait, there's more. Turns out DeVoe has now somehow managed to inhabit the chair in true sci-fi fashion. So it's Marlies who pulls out the charge for his chair, and then DeVoe is really dead. But wait, there's even more. The satellite has turned back on and is finishing the plan to dumb down humanity. Barry actually gets to run in an attempt to stop it, but time seems to rewind, and when his heroic save is repeated, there's another speedster who helps him take down the satellite and save Central City. With the city saved, Cecile finally has her baby, because she's suddenly allowed to. Ralph is alive. Harry regains some of his intelligence and decides to go be with his daughter on Earth too, but not before giving everyone a nice group hug and an emotional I love you too. Over at the West House, everyone is celebrating the birth of Jenna Marie West. Barry and Iris adore her already, and Wally even makes a nice appearance. Iris tells Barry that they're next to have a baby, and Barry gets all adorably rambly and nervous. She tells him to relax and that having a baby is for someday, not now. Only for moments later, Mystery Girl, knocking on their door, barges in and reveals herself to be Nora, Barry and Iris' daughter from the future, and she thinks she's made a big, big mistake. And that is what you miss on the Flash season finale. What did we like about this episode?
I actually liked quite a bit about this episode, about the finale. Like, first and foremost, seeing telling Barry that he could have his job back thanks to the mayor reading Iris' post on Clifford. I like this for two reasons. One, I was starting to think they had forgot all about that particular thread about Barry not having a job anymore. So I'm like, when is he going to get his job back? And I was like, today! And then two, incorporating Iris' journalism as the reason that Barry got his job back, because that's how the show should work, I feel like. Iris is just restarting her whole journalism and somehow got the whole city and secret government organizations like Argus following her posts. So, like, she's so powerful. And so, like, next season, even I feel like from this point, how many, like, followers she's gotten in just a short amount of time, like, next season, even the DEO will check out the Central City System, get in cross-reference anachronisms on the Legends Time Ship with Central City Citizen's articles, and then it'll be the only source of news that they get on Krypton. It's that influential.
But Drew Zod will be reading up on what's right. happening on Earth.
Because, like, they're all, you know, well, in New Seattle's just going to be getting Central City Citizen, like, news reports for, like, their outside world news.
Does Seg get internet connection in the Phantom Zone?
I don't know. He probably, like, he can see all different kinds of features. One of them is going to be Iris. But, like, seriously, with all the importance and Iris being the connection to the city. I hope that we continue to see this, like, push forward into season 5, and that it'll continue to be, like, an underlying threat. Like, don't make it so important just for plot in season 4 and then, like, completely drop in season 5. I'd like to see that be continue and for it to grow, because Central City Citizen has to, like, evolve some kind of way. I love how, even aside from all of the, like, quote-unquote team and family moments, there's still little hints of, like, Wes Allen as separate from that. Like, they're part of that, but they're also, like, separate from it. Iris is the main one that's communicating with Barry in the Mindscape, and particularly when Ralph tells Barry to distract his mind with something that he loves, he says, "It's you and me, Iris." And that's the only thing that he says. So, like, Ralph is going all bubblegum shrimp company with all the different varieties of shrimp that you can think of every time he hits, like a DeVoe. And the writers could have gone the same with Barry, listing all the members of, like, Team Flash, you know, We Are the Flash kind of style about, you know, I'm going to remember Joe and Cecile and Cisco and Kaylin and Harry. You're all my family. But he only says you and me, Iris. And that's all that he needs. So, like, Iris, again, it's like Iris powers the Flash. And in my opinion, it keeps We Are the Flash special between him and Iris, because it's not something in that moment that he needed to be strong. It was just him and Iris, and not, like, it didn't include the rest of the team in that moment.
Jessica, this entire explanation is making me melt into a puddle of goop, because it's so beautiful.
That's what I'm here for. Yes. Similarly, at the end with the, you know, goodbye villain who is now your friend speech, when they're saying, like, goodbye to Marlise, it's Barry and Iris saying goodbye to Marlise. So it's not like a team and Marlise. Like, you're leaving our family. Oh, how sad for you. But it's, like, Barry and Iris together saying goodbye to Marlise. And then when she says, like, you have all the help you need, she gestures at Iris, because she's, like, Iris is it for Barry. You can imply the rest of the team is included. Like, rest, you know, you have all the help, including, you know, Harry, Cisco, Caitlin, Joe, everybody else. But I think Marlise also just means Iris. You have Iris, seeing as how it's the final kind of contrast between their marriage and hers. And now she doesn't have Clifford, because, like, their marriage wasn't strong enough compared to Barry and Iris's. So, that is that on that. We Are the Flash. Speaking of Marlise, I love the little understated friendship between her and Iris throughout the episode. Kim and Candace's chemistry really shone through in selling how two women whose relationship up until that point was pretty much like Kill Bill sirens every time they saw each other reached an understanding, to the point of Iris and Barry offering her a job when all was said and done, and then, like, her and Marlise hugging and leaving on, like, such a good note. And I was, like, low-key impressed when Iris defended her, like, Lady Bay from her father. Like, Joe was, like, going off. And I was like, hold up, whoa. I was like, it's almost, like, the same level of her defending Barry. Like, yes. It reminded me of, like, the pilot when, like, Joe was going off on Barry. And she's like, that's enough, Dad. It's kind of like the same here. So, basically, this crack ship is valid.
Yes.
Other relationships that I loved, Harry and Cisco. I thought that they had some really sweet moments, especially, like, the final time when Harry asked Cisco to help him with the thinking cap, even though they both know that they'll be frying what's left, what little brain cells he has left. I liked the ending scene once they've, like, quote-unquote fixed him. He's not the same as he was, but he assures them that he's happy with his new normal, and they say, like, goodbye. I thought that was really sweet. I think that saying goodbye to Harry is the closest I think the cast has felt as a unit in a scene. It was really heartwarming, and there were a lot of little comedic touches that I won't mention because I know Tati and May will mention them coming up. I liked Joe going to protective papa mode, like, stay away from my girls. I thought that was really cute. I know that people can't stand the side of Ralph, but I think that he didn't ever take or dominate the plot, which, since we know he's coming back, if they can keep this same muted version of Ralph that they had in the finale, I think it should be okay. Like, it won't bother me if the Ralph we see in the finale and the amount of Ralph we saw in the finale is what we get going forward in season 5.
Yeah, I think if we can get, like, a redeemed here. Ralph Monel season 3 style, but
yes,
less, a little less, and then it's, I think it's fine.
Yeah, especially if they do, like, the pair thing where it's not just Ralph and, you know, the Ralph show, mm-hmm. and whoever Ralph is paired with is not the, their story is not about Ralph, mm-hmm. then I think it'll be fine.
And it'll be even better if he takes a 6-episode vacation like Mon-El did. Yes.
Yeah. The visual effects of Barry stopping the satellite and the freeze rewind when Nora changes the timeline to save him was really cool, like visually cool. Jenna Marie West is adorable. Little cute chubby baby. And Barry, like, developing performance anxiety at the mention of having kids, like, one day was hilarious. Like, I could see him, like, calculating in his head, like, the best way. Because, like, looking at ICE strategies and how they can, like, leave the West House quietly to go get started on this baby-making plot, like, idea. Like, how can I give Iris a baby? Like, he's, like, going through, like, calculations in his head. She's like, relax. And then the very next scene, he gets, like, a whole-ass daughter.
Yeah.
Like, could not, like, hide his amusement at all at the situation that Barry has found himself in. And it just made the whole thing even more hilarious because you can see, like, Grant laughing at the situation in the scene. And then a minor light, because I'm sure that no one else will probably say it, but I thought that the sliver of progression in Caitlin's storyline was nice with the Thomas line. It was effectively creepy and understated enough to not feel, like, glaringly out of place in the finale, but it was a nice, like, good little setup for her storyline in season 5.
You have no faith. We would have, you're right. No, I wouldn't have mentioned that, but thank you.
I may not have mentioned it, but I agree with it.
Yes.
Like, I did think that it was well placed.
Yeah.
And that it didn't, cause it didn't just throw away the Caitlin plot line of the season.
Right.
But there's also not a place for, there wouldn't have really been a place for it because it's literally an hour. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense to just give it that little, like, put a pin in this and we'll come back to it.
And I actually think it was better played than it was in the previous episode when Cecile was channeling her. Uh-huh. I feel like it was just, like, understated and you're just like, oh, Thomas. All right.
Yeah. It's Thomas. Obviously her dad.
Yes. Is that all your likes?
The extent of your likes?
Yeah.
All right. My likes. Let's see. I was really happy with the opening sequence, just like Jessica, because not only did we see my favorite bit characters sing, but we also got to see how Central City at large was affected by the commencement of the Enlightenment, which I always love seeing Central City and what is at stake. So that made me really happy. And of course, it also made me really happy that Iris' journalism was affecting changes in the city already. And I like that Singh knew it was Iris's blog, even though it says anonymous Central City citizen, because Singh was there when she was first writing her blog, and it looks exactly the same. So obviously he knows it's her. Plus, we all know that Singh really knows that Barry is the Flash.
Yes!
He's just not saying anything because he's polite.
So, we all knew that Lena knew that Kara was Supergirl.
That's totally different. It is totally different.
Singh is too, we all like, know. He's a minor enough character that if he knows, like, it's not going to be, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, and Alan, I already knew that.
He feels exactly the same way about Barry as he does about the Flash. Unlike Lena, who feels very differently about Kara and Supergirl. All right? Anyway, it's fine. I loved it. I love that the mayor reads Iris's blog. And was like, yeah, this girl makes some excellent points. So in general, I liked all the small Iris touches in the finale because it was a very much an ensemble episode. And unfortunately, ensemble for the Flash means everyone stands around and starts laughs in undefined ways. So it was nice that Iris's ways were a little bit more defined, like her journalism start, like the fact that she's the one that brought in Marlies, like the fact that she's the one keeping the communication line open with Barry, right? She's the one that's primarily talking to him in the mindscape, that she's the one delegating to the team what they should do, and, of course, that she is the one that Barry thinks about when he needs to power himself, like Jess mentioned. She also pointed out the small West Allen moment at Star Labs, where Marlies showcases how they are a team, unlike how she and Clifford were not a team, which was great. But I also loved their ad-libs, just how natural a lot of their little dialogue moments were together in this episode. Obviously, we know that Star Wars, right, when Harry and Sisko hug and quote Star Trek, which was a great moment, by the way. I love that whole bit. I love Harry and Sisko in this episode. Iris then turns so proudly and says, Star Wars! And Barry has to be like, no, it's not actually. That was so great, and we know it was an ad-lib, so.
She was so confident, and he was like, no. He's like, I don't know where you're getting this information from, but it's inaccurate.
And I will admit that I didn't get it at first, because I don't know Star Trek like that. And I didn't, like, when Sisko said Khan, I thought he said, oh my god. So I didn't know that he was, but if I had heard Khan, then I would know it was Star Trek. So I was just like, Is that from Star Wars? I don't remember that. And then it's like, his face clearly means it's not from Star Wars, but I don't understand what's happening. But then when I rewatched it, I knew it was Star Trek. It was hilarious.
I got the reference, and I just comically how, like, Barry's, he turns to her and he's smiling, and then he's like, no.
Oh, yeah, exactly. He's like, his face was so slow. He's like, oh, wait, what? No, that's not right. Like,
have I taught you nothing?
As a husband and as a nerd that I did not. Star Wars and Star Trek, and I feel like RIP and all those fans, like, back in season one, we had canons, like, Iris as, like, a Star Trek junkie with Barry, because, like, now their headcanons are ruined, because she does not know.
No, she does not know Star Trek. Although, to be fair, she may just have not seen classic Star Trek, right? She might like the 2009 movie, and then heard that Into Darkness was shit, so she didn't check it out.
But then how did she get Star Wars out of that?
Because she's like Star Wars, that's right. But yes, Barry is very, he's not good at sharing his passions, clearly.
Well, I feel like Barry could be more of a Star Wars person, so that's why she thought that was the reference.
And there you go, not as there much you go. Maybe that's what it was. Maybe that's what it was. And he failed in the general education side.
Like, I missed one too many, like, anime club meetings during high school.
Anyway. So, I also loved when Iris was asking Barry about having kids, and he freaked out, but that also felt like an ad-lib. Like, I feel like part of that scene was just them riffing, because things were repeated too naturally and too often for it to have actually been scripted. They don't write like that. So, anyway, I really liked it, though. I really liked Marlies, you know, having her redemption and, like, not having to die. Because I feel like a lot of times on these shows, in order to be redeemed, you have to die for it, right? You got to be like, oh, I will sacrifice myself for you. So I'm glad that didn't happen. And I thought that her arc was one of the best in the whole season. So I'm glad that we got to see it through to its natural conclusion, even though I'm sad that we will not see more of her. I really was sad when, you know, like, we saw that Clifford had erased her from his subconscious, basically, right? Mm-hmm. And so I felt really bad for her, and then I was proud of her when she had to say goodbye to him at the end. So I thought that was, like, a nice, you know, subtle beat there. Also, Harry and Sisko, like I said, were surprisingly great this episode. I was surprised by how emotional they made me. I love Tom and Carlos's chemistry, and I think that this version of Harry, right, Harry Earth 2, is the one that has the closest bond with Sisko. Mm-hmm. Because it's like... we got to see how Sisko sort of, like, pieced back together the relationship he had with the first Wells, who wound up being Abarth Vaughn, with a man that actually does care about him, even though he has a really hard time showing it. So I also liked that Harry decided that he valued his emotional intelligence instead of continuing to try to recover his scientific knowledge and his, like, I don't know, whatever, regular intelligence, you will. I know some people wanted him to get his regular intelligence back, but I felt like, I don't know, I kind of like that he didn't, and also that he was happy with it, because it would be easy if he got it back to be like, oh yeah, but I have my emotional intelligence now, so, like, that's what's really important.
Like, even if they got his, if he got, like, his regular intelligence, whatever, mm-hmm. then it would just undercut the whole storyline that he mm-hmm. went through to develop his emotional intelligence, because right. it would be easy to slip back into that. Well, I don't have to do this anymore because I'm smart now, or I'm smart.
Right. And also it is his punishment, because he did, you know, fall prey to his own hubris, right? So you don't have to rectify what he did to himself.
Yeah.
So it's not like he was just, like, a random victim in the situation. He literally did it to himself. So I think it makes sense for him to have learned his lesson and also not get that back. Kind of like with Flashback, right? Like, Barry can't fix time. There's always going to be the whatever cracks. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, so I like that. There are other things that I liked. I like that even though I wish that we had gotten to see Jesse, and I know that Violet, you know, could not be there, but I think it's nice that he decided to return to his daughter and be with his family, right? It opens that door to, like, family is what really matters. And it makes sense, like, because he came to the team to save his daughter, right? Now he has his daughter is safe. Now he knows how to connect with his daughter better, so why wouldn't he go back to her? It makes perfect sense to me. So, yes, of course, the Sisko's desperation to save Harry throughout the episode was really beautiful, and I love that he's, like, because he thought that's what Harry wanted, like, he didn't want to give up, right? He didn't want to stop short of
giving Harry back exactly what he wanted. And so that's why Harry had to be like, actually, I'm happy with who I am now. So that was very sweet. And like I said, the Star Trek quote was great. And the I love you too moment. I love that so much. When Sisko was like, oh, there's no one like you. And then Harry was like, I love you too. So I was like, aw. Weep, 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 weep. And I agree with you that it was the best, like, group team effort scene. You know, like, it really felt like these were people who liked being in scenes together. We were sad to see one person leave. So I agree.
Who will be back in some form next season.
Yeah, of course we'll be back next season, but it's fine. But I also really liked Joe, like, being like, you know, no one touches my girls or whatever, right? Stay away from my girls. Like, that's so cute, Joe. And I also thought it was cute that, like, he immediately failed. He was like, one thing I don't, well, that's going to go on my dislikes. I'll remember that for later. Put a pin in that. Anyway, Jenna Marie, who has the most random name ever, is super adorable. Even though she's definitely not a newborn baby, but that's all right. And having Wally back was a blessing. Well, like you already mentioned, the satellite fight and the rewind was visually really interesting. And I was glad that they did that. It created some excitement too, because the rest of the battle against the bow was kind of like, meh. But then like the battle against the satellite, I liked it a lot too in episode 22. I thought it looked really good. So did it again. The rewind made it even better. But the best scene in the whole finale for me was the scene at Joe's house where everyone's gathering together. Everyone's greeting Jenna Marie and Wally's talking about his feelings, because it's one of the few times that we really got to focus on like the family dynamic and the heart of the show. Like the reason that we watch is for these characters and their relationships to each other. So that made me really happy. Of course, Nora Dawn Allen revealing herself took the cake. And she's definitely like, she babbles like her dad. She's wearing her mom's jacket. You know, she looks like Iris. She made a huge time travel mistake. Obviously, she is their child. And the real reason that I cannot wait for season 5. And then finally, on my final point, I really liked that the battle against Bo was a team effort. Everyone had some part to play in it, but it was Barry who saved the day in the end, right? I feel like in season 3, Barry very much did not. Like, I mean, he took down Savitar, but in the end, like, they had, like first Caitlin had to do it, or Killer Frost really had to do it, Sisko had to do it, like, everyone had to do it, and then it was, like, Barry just kind of, like, punched him for a while until Iris shot him. So I'm glad that this time he really did make that, like, that big final, the big final sequence was him and Dawn. Sorry, Nora and Nora. But
get used to it, Tati. You have 5 months to prep calling her Nora.
No, I know. It's really hard. I'm going to keep calling her Dawn. I really hope that her middle name's Dawn. Anyway, I liked it that he got to save the day, but that at the same time, we got to see that everyone has a purpose, right? So it was nice. It was a nice balance, I thought. All right.
Yeah. Oh, then my turn.
Yes.
I also love that Captain Sink showed up. I love every time he shows up, and I think he needs to be on the show more often. I want season 5 for them to gift me with Alan and then just have like a scene. And I also love that the mayor reads Iris's blog, and I think that is how he's going to get his job back. And it's like the world building we truly deserve. And I did like that. Several moments in the finale, one of which was the show's consistency in continuing to recognize Iris's blog 3 episodes in a row. This is what brings me hope that we will actually be getting journalism stuff for her in season 5. You know what they call that? Growth. Thank you, writers. I also like that since the electricity was going out and there was a big satellite coming at Central City, that all its citizens felt included in the events, which is what should have been happening all season. So when they were clapping for the Flash at the end of the episode for stopping the satellite, his save felt more earned than it did at the end of 410 when he stopped the nuclear man, whose name I've already forgotten. Protective Daddy Joe, it's been so long since I have seen you, and I have missed you. And I like that he was holding Marlies accountable for her actions and for jeopardizing the safety of his family. And I like that Iris stood up to him and used the words he said to her in the season 4 premiere. And I think there were a lot of parallels to 4-1 in a lot of ways. And I like that Marlies and Iris' relationship felt really natural, and there was a great progression from enemies to comrades, and they were working side by side. And I like that Iris came to her defense and really allowed Marlies to help make up for her past mistakes. And it's what a true redemption story felt like. She was held responsible for her actions and then given the chance to make amends and not made out to be a victim of her circumstances because she wasn't completely blameless either. And I really felt for her when she discovered that Clifford had wiped clean the memory of her in his mind. I think that really helped her in going all in with defeating him and knowing clearly that he no longer held her in as high regard as he once did. And I feel like, just like Tati said, she's had one of the most developed arcs this season, and I'm really truly sad to see her go. But I'm also really happy that she didn't die. And I also love that she was asked to join the team and that it was just Barry and Iris who asked her, like everybody else just left. And it's just like, oh, we'll just leave them to talk. It's kind of like when Barry and Iris have their little side discussions while everybody else is just doing something else. And I like that in that moment, Marlies realized that she'd like to get back to truly helping people with her inventions and recognize that Barry had Iris and Iris had Barry. And that made me sad because it was, you know, like you said, it was her coming to terms that that support is not what she ended up having with Clifford. So many emotions. And I also appreciate the fact that it was Marlies who took down Clifford the final time because he's really been her villain more than he's been anyone else's villain for the entire season. And I'm happy that she wasn't robbed of that moment. I'm also glad that they didn't make the We Are the Flash line specifically extend to the rest of the team. But I also really did like that Team Flash felt more like a unit, specifically with the final scene with all of them gathered at Joe's and then Harry's goodbye scene. You really felt that camaraderie. And I love, like Tati said about them, well, like you both said, about them feeling like a true unit. So that was nice. The hug is a gift I saved. Side note. But also that Barry and Iris did stand separately in from the team in certain instances to distinguish them as being a top tier with regards to the team. So like speaking of Harry's goodbye scene, I didn't think that I'd be so emotionally affected, but I absolutely was. When he wasn't able to complete his sentences and Cisco helped him put on the thinking cap and then told him that he isn't losing anyone else, my mind just went to Cynthia and how Cisco thinks he's lost her, and I got really sad, so he didn't want to lose Harry either because Harry's is like one of the closest people to him. And then in the goodbye scene with everyone being upset that his full intelligence wasn't restored, but that it was Harry who thought it was a good thing, really felt like the greatest character development he's ever had. And yeah. I choked on my water when Iris was so giddy and confident that she recognized the reference, but then goes and says it's Star Wars instead of Star Trek. And then watching Barry smile, like I said earlier, just fade from his face. And it's just like, why would you get that wrong? I don't understand. So I thought that was really cute. And the entire action sequence at the end was really good. Cisco got to shine using his powers, and then Nora saving Barry. When time froze and rewound, I was like, oh shit, she's gonna show up. And she did, and it was glorious.
I was confused at first, actually. So, like, wait a minute. Like, what are we doing?
No, like, as soon as it backed up, I was like, oh, she's here. Even though, like, I knew she was gonna show up, but, like, it was the first time. And I love that they did highlight the purple lightning, and the shot of her arm next to Barry was just gorgeous. And, yeah, I was just really excited for her to finally appear in a more permanent way. And before getting to everything else, I do want to say that I did not get annoyed of Ralph during the episode. I know, I am shocked. He was definitely more muted, like Jess said, and the reason I don't mind that he's alive is because of Barry. I wasn't ecstatic to see him, but if it means that Barry gets to have at least one win with one of the bus metas in a season where they all died, then I'm okay with this, even though they did all deserve to live. And also, Ralph didn't take away anything from Barry. Like, he helped, but it was Barry who was the hero. Barry who came up with the plan on how to leave the mindscape, and Barry who took down the satellite. Nora's help is okay. Like, he was the hero Central City was seeing, and that's as it should be on a show called The Flash. So I'm really happy he had quite a few wins in the episode. And I also like the continuity of Iris helping to power Barry in the same way we've seen constantly. It really brings power to the line, "The thought of you is what picks me up and keeps me going." Because I felt like the moment he says, "It's you and me, Iris," really paralleled 121 when he says her name and then powers up to take down Grodd. But what's funny to me was, like, Ralph was over here thinking about all the food that he loves, and Barry's the one, like, nope, it's Iris, and that's what powers him through to take down the multiple Devos. Also really loved how confident Barry was as he gets up and walks over to DeVoe after he escapes the mindscape. And this is what I want to see more of, a Barry that is sure he's winning, you know, every once in a while. Finally, I love the comical aspect of Iris bringing up babies, Barry's hilarious reaction, and then having Nora walk to the door moments later. Iconic. And I also love that even though the whole team was in the room, the conversation ended up being more very focused on Iris and Barry's reaction specifically. So it was a finale where things ended up on a happy note and exciting things to come, and no one died or disappeared. So that's never happened before. So I call that a win for season four. Yeah.
I have to point out, Ivy, and I don't know if this is in her email or not, but she did make a really funny post on Twitter with Caitlin's reaction to Nora.
And
didn't you spill coffee on me? And she said, like, Nora's like, didn't you try to kill my parents?
She was kind of, like, very proud of that moment. She was like, oh, yeah, I did spill coffee on you. What is she hiding? Anyway, what did we not like after my long rambling?
What did we not like?
Tatiana.
Oh, me first?
Sure.
All right. What did we not like? All right. Like I mentioned before, it's way too much of all our characters trapped inside Star Labs waiting for Barry to get out of the Mindscape. So that part of the episode felt a little stagnant. And the fact that Cecile, poor Cecile had to have her baby there. Jesus Christ. I was so sad. I was like, why? Why is everything here? But I thought that the Mindscape could have been a little bit trippier. Like, I thought that 221 and 316 had more emotionally resonant beats in them than the Mindscape in this episode did. It was kind of like, they could have gone a little further with, like, the bits of DeVoe basically erasing Marlies. You know, like, we could have had more of a reaction to that being what's happening to make it a little bit more meaningful. Or DeVoe could have actually had traps for Barry in his mind once he knew that Barry was there. You know, something to make it a little bit more, you know, like, oh, let's just have a million DeVoe clones.
Yeah, like he could have tricked Barry using his own emotions against him.
Like, yeah, exactly. And then you know, just twirl Ralph around to defeat him. Like, I was like, all right, I guess. It's like, it wasn't bad, but it was also just like, it could have been more exciting. I didn't ask for Ralph back. I feel betrayed that he's back. So this is why I'm getting a divorce. Even though he did not bother me so much in the episode, I just didn't want to see his face. But like May said, it is good for Barry to get a win, so I'm glad. And this is a nitpick, but when Barry said, it's you and me, Iris, we should have gotten a West Allen montage. I'm just saying. Like, Ralph got to call out random shrimp dishes that he liked, so I feel like I don't want Barry being like, that time that we kissed, or that whatever, but I would like to see it. Anyway, that's fine. I also, yeah, like I sort of hinted before, I would have liked Marlies to have a little more active of a role, because it was really sad that Clifford erased her, and it seemed like he didn't have any love left for her, right? Like, he sort of just, like, chucked that part out of it. So I would have liked an extra beat of her contending with that. Like, if good DeVoe, who was dead, was, like, holding a photo of Marlies or something, you know? Like, something about Marlies on dead DeVoe to, like, just drive home the point.
The place where good DeVoe felt like the best was at school and not any of the places where Marlies was.
That was weird,
because we didn't spend that much time on teacher DeVoe, so like, what do we care? And he was like a grouchy man when he met Marlies.
Exactly. So, I mean, I guess, like, the good, like, his original intention of the enlightenment was good, but still, it was kind of like, well, is Marlies like chopped liver? Like,
yeah, exactly. And then another nitpick, but I do feel like they could have named the baby Danielle just to scare people. And I don't know why they chose Jenna Marie.
It's like, Tali, did you really want that phantom anxiety over the hiatus? Where, like, Danielle is like the Daniel West. You know, like, I'm kind of relieved her name isn't Danielle, for the reason that you're disappointed that it wasn't.
I wanted it. But yes, now it's your turn.
But I mean, like, plus the fact that it's a normal baby also plays, like, into my massive Nora season 5 prediction, which I will preview for you guys in the prediction section. But otherwise, I too thought they could have done more with DeVoe's Mindscape than they did. I didn't really like that Cecile had to be the link between Barry's consciousness and the Mindscape. and then she just so conveniently loses her powers when the baby's born. Because I just don't feel like this. That's a lot of stress for a baby being born, to have their mom, like, holding her mind open between two parallel worlds. It was kind of a lot for her to take on in that situation when she should just be focusing on having a baby. Plus, I'm disappointed that her inhabiting people's minds and personality ability wasn't used to warn of DeVoe's presence. Like, she said that she could hear his thoughts, things coming, but it would have been cool to see her, like, asshole out and be DeVoe for, like, a second, and that's how they know that he's there. But I guess they had to choose between her being Killer Frost or her being DeVoe, so they chose for her to be Killer Frost to get the Thomas line instead of, you know, the whole DeVoe route. So that's whatever. But the ugliest part of using Cecile was DeVoe planning to, like, choke her out. Like, the fact that he got into the pocket dimension and he's just, like, standing over her and she's, like, clearly pregnant and he's, like, choking her out, trying to kill her, I thought was super ugly. And it seemed like it took forever to rush to see her. And if it seemed that way, maybe it's because Barry's dumbass had the great idea to save Ralph and stop, like, a mile and a half from where he needed to, like, throw Ralph in to get this, like, out of the way and over with. Like, just to get the fight scene with all the other DeVos. So, Barry, like, you couldn't have this, like, little exposition chat, like, by the bus right where the portal is. You could just, like, toss him in. Like, you had to stop a mile and a half away just so we could get this, like, dramatic fight sequence. Why are you stopping so far away from the endpoint? Like, it didn't, that kind of, like, frustrated me. Mm-hmm. They stopped just to have this talk they could have had at least a little bit closer to where they needed to go. And then DeVoe's, like, second villain resurrection could have been cool, but it turned out to be, like, a little bit lame. Like, all Marlies had to do was, like, unplug him. So it's like, what was the point? What was the point of you coming back, DeVoe? There was no point.
Yeah. Your point about Cecile, which I totally agree with, that was ugly, reminded me of the dislike that I forgot to say, which is that I am tired of villains making Joe turn a gun on himself, and I hope I never see that again. It must be stopped. It must end. But yeah, that is all.
I saw that and I was like, they are not repeating this shit. Poor Joe. Oh, okay, you guys are done.
Yeah, it's your turn now, man.
It's poor Joe, because, like, four seasons, and you're like, oh my god, if you kill him, I swear to God. I do not need this kind of stress. I knew they weren't going to kill Cecile, thankfully. But I'm also divorcing Todd, but on your behalf this time, because he lied. Ralph wasn't dead. He wasn't dead, and I feel betrayed.
No.
And I think him being part of the family is the only thing that didn't work for me team-wise. Like, he hasn't really earned that place yet. But whatever. So I'm glad that he wasn't in the scenes with Harry saying goodbye, because he wasn't like that with him, you know? And while I didn't find him annoying here, nor did he overshadow the episode, my concern is that he will be back for season 5, and I really don't want that if it means it'll be a repeat of what we got in season 4, because that was exhausting and I don't want to have to deal with that again. Overall, I just felt like the finale was just anticlimactic. DeVoe was defeated far too easily, and even when he wasn't dead the first time, him being tied to the chair afterwards was something I just shrugged at, like, okay, fine, whatever. And even the mindscape stuff could have been more compelling. It was basically Barry walking through a street, through a house, and through a field, and I think it would have been more emotionally driven and engaging had we seen DeVoe struggle with the memory of Marlies, and the fact that somewhere deep down he did still care for her, and she held power over him despite his turn to the bad side. And I think it would have nicely paralleled Barry's line about Iris when he thought of her to defeat DeVoe, and then have it turn into the opposite so that we see how DeVoe's badness still overshadowed his good, which should have been Marlies, if that makes sense. But in general, the finale was just a mixed bag, and I agree with everything you guys said. There were good moments, because I went on for a while about those good moments, but as an episode, there was just not enough tension and stakes for me, and that has been most of 4B, to be honest. And finally, I thought that was what was ultimately missing from the episode were the more emotional character moments. Besides the Harry subplot, I feel like everyone was still hanging around Star Labs, but for a while nothing was really happening. And those moments could have been cut to involve a one-on-one scene between Barry and Iris, since they did use the lightning rod concept again, but we didn't really get a major moment between them. And I'm a bit disappointed by that. I'm not mad we didn't get a montage like Tati, but I think having her say something while he's still in DeVoe's mind, or a moment after he gets out, would have helped. And even a bigger moment, what should have happened between Marlies and Clifford, and, you know, that didn't. So just in general, there wasn't enough heart for me in the episode. But moving into predictions for season 5, what do we think is going to happen?
Well, since Jessica's prediction is much more involved, I guess I will just say that I think that's not supposed to help her father stop Satellite, and that this has messed up the future. So, either, like, obviously we have two schools of thought, right? Like, either Iris is pregnant now, and for whatever reason they didn't drop that cliffhanger in the finale, which is a little strange, and this is when Barry should have died, and so by saving him, she's changed the future and made it much worse, even though Barry's alive. She's created her own flashpoint. Or she made a mistake earlier on, and then she had to save Barry to correct that mistake, and now she's threatening her own existence, I assume. Or threatening something else. It doesn't have to be her own existence. Aside from that, the reason that she was so awkward with Iris before was because Iris specifically told her, no time traveling, that. And so then she was going to be grounded for life. But now she has to talk to Iris because otherwise she's not going to get the help she needs. So it doesn't matter anyway. And finally, like we have said, Thomas is Caitlin's dad, and he had the X-Men gene, and that turned Caitlin into Killer Frost, and also probably is what killed him instead of ALS. All right.
Oh, yes. And yes, my only prediction, too, is that Nora helped Barry with the satellite because he wasn't supposed to die. And since she's shown up at different points in time before, I think she fucked something up earlier on the timeline and ended with Barry taking down the satellite on his own when he wasn't supposed to. And so she intervened because he wasn't supposed to die in that moment, because she created that moment. And also, right. I think everything will somehow connect back to the Speed Force itself. Harry was writing the symbols on the board, the same symbols we saw Barry and Nora writing at some point. So Barry in 4-1 and Nora in 4-13, I think. And so I think they could find a way to eventually use the Speed Force to fix it, like maybe another trip into the Speed Force like we saw in 221. And that could be interesting.
About the Speed Force symbols, I don't know if they're actually Speed Force symbols, because DeVoe's still writing them on his chalkboard back in, like, episode 7. And I think they are the symbols that Marlies used to give them the formula of how to fix Harry. And Cisco, I have to go back and watch it, and I'll have to go back and watch it for my article anyway, but I think Cisco said that they're like bifactorial binomials or something that does exist in the real world, but was being used for another purpose, to, like, when Harry was lost his mind and all he could do was think in shapes, he was using those shapes to write out, you know, random words and sentences, which is what Barry picked up on when he came back from, like, Speed Force and the premiere. So, and our, like, all of that, because, like, Nora was also writing in those symbols, but I don't know if this necessarily, like, the Speed Force, or just if that was in the premiere, Barry foreshadowing what was going to happen to Harry and how to fix Harry in the finale. So I don't know about that. I'll have to go back and, like, look at it more closely to see what I think it was. But I do agree with you on that Nora saving Barry from the satellite in the finale is not the change that fucked up her future, and that she's been doing stuff even before then. And all of that, those, it's like the butterfly effect, that one change created this snowball effect that led to them defeating DeVoe, not the way that they were originally supposed to defeat DeVoe, which meant Barry was going to die in this timeline, and her having to save him, not only to fix her previous mistakes, but also to ensure that she was actually going to, like, be alive in the future. So, I'm going to write, because this is, I have, like, a, it's like a massive theory that goes
out. Jess has her own board where she's like, oh my,
yeah,
this.
I have my own board. I am Iris and Barry right now, and I have, like, a board and, like, red drawings all over it to show you, like, how this is going to, like, map out. I'm going to, like, write it out. I'm going to post it on With an Accent. But, basically, like, the short version that's probably not going to wind up being very short is that I think that like May said, she messed up way before the finale. And the four times that we see her come back into the past are her checking to make sure that the timeline is still in check. But each time that she comes back, something else changes and makes things worse to the point where, you know, you get Barry dying in the finale, which erases Nora's birth, because I don't think Iris is pregnant now. I do think that Iris was supposed to be pregnant this season, and that Cecile being pregnant is the first sign of changes that Nora made to the timeline. I think so there's something like going on in the future that needs the Flash. And since we know that Barry disappeared in 2024, like he's not around now, but Nora thinks that if she can make one tiny, not drastic, like saving Barry's mother, like what he did, but if she made like one tiny little change to the timeline, like maybe, for example, helping Team Flash secretly get her father out of the Speed Force in the premiere a couple of milliseconds earlier than he was supposed to, that might be enough that he wouldn't disappear in 2024 and he'd still be around to help her in the future. And I think that's what she did as far as like going, because I remember like in the premiere, May, you were really suspicious about Harry because he was like, I don't really trust my numbers. And Cisco was like, how can you not trust your numbers? You're you. He's like, well, maybe they weren't his numbers. And at the time, we thought it was maybe DeVoe had slipped into him, but what if it was Nora? Nora gives, like, secretly leaves, like, the correct calculations to get Barry out of the Speed Force. And at the time, Harry just passes off to Cisco, and then Cisco actually uses that. Like, maybe if Harry would have eventually gotten to that point, but the fact that Nora had already helped him out, got Barry out,
like, jump-started it.
He was supposed to. And that started the changes. Cecile got pregnant instead of Iris.
So how'd that happen?
Whatever, like, little...
I know, I'm joking.
Butterfly. Would the Flash have had Iris pregnant before she was a married woman, Jess?
I really do. Anyways, but I think, like, the whole situation of, like, Cecile's pregnancy was supposed to be Iris's pregnancy, and it turned out to not be that, is, like, the first sign of things starting to change. So she comes back during the wedding to check on the timeline, make sure, you know, Dad, please marry my mom. Say, remember to say I do, because I need this timeline to stick. And then maybe that's the reason why the Nazis showed up at the wedding. Like, maybe they weren't originally crashed by Nazis, but because Nora Dawn shows up, the Nazis are suddenly here. And then she comes back again, and she comes back again. Every time she comes back to check on things.
So it's her fault and not Elicity's.
Not Elicity's fault that Nazis crashed. It's still their fault that they crashed the second wedding.
Yes.
But it could have been Nora coming back into the timeline that caused, like, other stuff to snowball. So that by the time that you get to episode 20 in the baby shower, you know, and she says that very specifically, you know, looks like you're super pregnant and your child will be born 21 days from now. I think she was talking about the time that she was originally supposed to be born and not the time that her aunt was supposed to be born. So the 21 days could just have been like her, you know, like, that could have been me, but it's not, you know, kind of thing. And it all kind of goes to her time is, you know, precious, relatively speaking, because she just kind of erased her own existence, kind of. And in that sense, like, her running away from Iris could be, you know, the first school of thought that Iris told her not to go back in time. Now she's, like, upset because things are, like, out of her control and, you know, she doesn't want to face her mother because her mother was right. Or it could also be, like, maybe in the future, Iris doesn't recognize Nora anymore. And so, like, Nora's starting to, like, lose more and more in her future. And then you get, obviously, in the finale with her having to save Barry because Barry's about to die when he shouldn't have died in the first place. And because of all of that happening, then she finally has to go in and be like, look, I made a mistake. You need to help me fix it because I need to be alive, kind of thing, going into season 5.
Mm-hmm.
And that is my big ass.
And I'm going to add on to that because it is a good theory. My only potential issue with it is that, you know, there could be time remnants or whatever, but I'll add on that to say that Iris could become pregnant in season 5 and then just have Nora at the end of season 5 instead.
Yeah, I definitely think that she's gonna have Nora at the end of season. Like, her birth is delayed, but like the whole tension of her being in season 5 makes me think, like, you know, when are y'all gonna conceive me and my brother?
right. And then I'm sure that when I do imagine that if this
theory or any version of this theory proves true, then it will be like when they're saying goodbye to Nora and they're like, I'm so sad. When are we going to see her again? And then we're like, oh, actually.
We'll see her in 9 months.
I also think that is when, because I do not think, you know, everyone's worried about Dawn and where he is. I don't think that Dawn is going to play a big factor in season 5. Like, I don't think we'll have an actor for him. I don't even know that Nora will mention Dawn very much, whether Barry tells her not to say anything about it because he doesn't want to know the future or whatever. She just decides not to do it until it's time for her to say goodbye. And they're like, you know, you're going to see me soon and my brother. Like, she's going to throw in her brother at the very end. And then that's when we'll get the payoff for the whole, we're going to need more diapers line. Or at least. I like it.
All right. You can read more about Jess's theory, her board of trying to track down the whole season 4, like, as she writes it. So keep an eye on that. And now we'll move into our Lady with Gumption nominations. Who do we nominate for Lady with Gumption of the Week and why?
Which ones would you nominate from Supergirl?
Tracy?
Is it Tracy or
Okay,
Tanya?
Well, she had gumption. You know what? She had gumption. Yes, that would be my nominee. If I had to stick to one per episode, then Tracy would be the one for Supergirl. Because she risked a lot to go to see Guardian, to go to see James. And
well,
then,
to leave the cult in the first place.
Yeah, to leave the cult, to go to see James, to then not take the out of him, you know, him revealing himself, and instead going back to face her abusers. And, yeah, and I don't think she even knew. Did she even know that Mon-El was Mike? Mm-mm. I don't think that she even knew that she had help.
I think she did. I think she knew that she had help because I think Kara told her that, you know, Mon-El was going to be there and it's going to be okay. But, the fact that she volunteered to give herself up to these crazy people in the first place because she wanted to stand up to her abusers, like you said, and stand up to her, you know, her fears about everything.
So, yeah, go Tracy. All right, Krypto. Lady with Gumption?
Lyta.
Yes. Basically.
Yeah.
Sure.
There was no one else. She came in after she had shot her mother. She gave a passion speech to the troops, sent them out to try to defeat Brainiac so she can help to save the city, and then also mourn them.
I feel like, because even with, especially I think even before that, when, you know, she was like, Lyta go, and Seg was like, Lyta no. And she's like, no, Lyta go. And she went. The fact, like I said, the fact that she was able to round up the Sagittari so quickly and, you know, do her goal was to, also, like, save the city. Like, she would, you know, get people out, but she was also going to, you know, save and possibly die for her city if need be. So I feel like, you could say, like, I don't know why any of us would say that Nyssa had gumption, but I, you know.
That's so terrible.
With, like, approaching Lyta to sneak out of the fortress anyway to go save her child. Like, she was very one mind directional and going to save her child. So I guess that could be like gumption, but she's not gonna get it today. Or probably ever, but not today. Not over Lyta.
Yes.
Okay. I accept that. But yes, I agree that Lyta would probably be the Krypton one. And then we have Flash.
Who would be the one for Flash? I wanna say Marley's. Because she came back to help the team try to basically take down her husband, which is very hard. She still obviously loves him, but she did the difficult thing and allowed Barry to enter his mind, which is a very sacred place. And
is it?
I mean, it is your walking diary, you know? But
yeah, she had to face a lot of angry people who did not, you know,
exactly. Yes.
She stood on her ground. And
then she had to face her husband who didn't love her anymore.
Right. She had to come to terms with the fact that she was no longer married, essentially. And then she did the final deed and took out, you know, took out Devo herself, and then also, and then also came to the conclusion that she's going to use her mind for good. To go
yeah,
back
I
to
like that she came out of it with an optimistic outlook. Again.
Yes,
like, that
yeah.
was good.
I feel like she had the most, like, it was a redemption story for her, and so for her to, like, come into the team, you know, have to face the effects of what she and Clifford did on other people, with Jill, like, yelling at her and her taking, and Cisco also got onto her, for what happened to Harry. So she did have to face a lot of that, and she did make amends, both with helping them defeat Clifford, as well as giving them the tools and technology to bring Harry back. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that she's really, she's probably the choice. Only
I would give Cecile an honorable mention.
Yeah, I was going to mention Cecile.
Yes, Cecile.
The fact she was, like, pregnant and still, like, stood up to the plate and held that link open between Barry and Devo's mind. And then poor little Nora, like, she's not going to get,
Aw, yes, because she helped her daddy.
Hey, you know what? That was very daring of her. She had a lot of options.
She was Tatiana, so.
What?
I know. She also caused a situation that she had to help.
No, but I mean, but the so fact did Marlies, that she had the gumption to do fair. It in the first place, is what I'm saying. Like, gumption isn't necessarily positive, so she did take that leap to go back in time in the first place to do whatever the fuck her plan was. And
really,
then
actively, like, give her a nom for, like, episode one when I think she showed up.
She's like, you get one for 4-7, for 4-13. Sorry,
yeah, and she kept having to come back, right? She kept having to go back and try to fix it. She didn't give up. She has a lot of gumption. And this time she had the balls to ask for help. Like, I fucked everything up. Please fix it.
Please fix my mistakes, Mom and Dad.
I've learned my lesson. Who do we want to win? Crown the final lady with gumption, because from now on, Supergirl is the only one that doesn't really count anymore.
It's gonna be a difficult movie. Well, we'll see. We'll see how Supergirl does. But I think this week is just between Marlies and Lyta, to be honest.
What? You Sorry. Don't think that Tanya stands a chance?
Rude.
She's Tanya. I call her Tracy. Did I call her Tracy?
You yeah. did call her Tracy. Her name is Tanya. But yes.
Sorry.
Clearly you
See, she's
you
right. She's not a Lady of Gumption nominee. You just can't remember her name.
Okay, like, all right.
You love Renee.
Oh, I really love him. And then his nameless face. Anyway.
She will cry when Curtis breaks up with him. It's fine.
Yep.
it's between Marlies and Lyta for me.
Okay.
And I feel like Marlies had the more redemptive yeah. story.
Yes.
So overall I would say Marlies.
Yeah, same.
Okay. All right. I'm gonna, you know, agree with Marlies. So yay!
Yay, Marlies. I think this is her third time.
Yeah, Marlies yes. really was like...
With her signature episode, she's been a lady with gumption yes. of the week.
You go, Marlies. Well, we're so proud
yeah,
of
they
you.
Did, they did right by her.
Yes.
Yeah.
So she wins our week 26, Lady with Gumption. We will be back next week. So we'll be back just recapping Supergirl and then going into discussions about sci-fi women and their evolution in the genre.
Among others.
Yes. So stay tuned, and thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Bye! Bye.